This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing the oral history interview with Dr. Tom Shepard. Today is the 20th of October, 2005. I am in Lubbock, and Dr. Shepard is speaking to me by telephone from Washington State. Tom, thanks again for your time. We appreciate this so much. There were a couple of things that you wanted to add from our previous session that had eluded you then or that have come to you since, I guess.
Right.
The first one was about...
The first one was the name of the interim division artillery commander between Hutton and Johnny Johnston, and that was John D. Byrne, spelled B-Y-R-N-E. He was a full colonel, regular army, and he was just a marvelous guy, and he held the fort until General Johnson got there. And just as an aside, later after I had retired and I was teaching down in Texas, I made it a point to drive up to New Mexico where Colonel John D. Byrne was an instructor in history in the New Mexico Military Academy, NMMA, and so I had a chance to visit with him, and this would have been circa 1978 or 79, somewhere in that area, and I met him at the school, and we went to his home, and during our lengthy reminiscences, the one thing that stood out was that Colonel Byrne was a little bit bitter that he had never been picked up for brigadier because he saw a lot of people who were that he didn't think had the same capabilities that he did. And I guess that's one of those natural things. When Johnny Johnson was saying to me, gee, I felt this antipathy at the party that, that we had, that they were saying behind my back and sometimes an innuendo to me, how come you made it and I didn't make it? So that was a sad thing. The other point was that while I was in the DeVardi S2 shop, there was an island called Kojido, about 50 miles, as I remember, off the southern tip of Korea, and that's where the UN forces were keeping their North Korean prisoners, and there were approximately 50,000 of them there in a series of prison camps. And we were requested or told that we would send troops from one of our battalions up on sort of a rotation to guard one of those camps. And since they were up there and I was in the S2 shop, I thought it would be good if I went up and took a look at it. So I did. And I had an opportunity to meet some of our troops from the 24th up there. And they took me on an evening tour walking on the outside of these barbed wire enclosures in which there would be huts and then a double barbed wire fence. I'd say each fence was perhaps 8 or 10 feet tall and had concertina wire along the tops of them. And between the two fences, that was open so that upon occasion we could either run groups of our troops in there to do some kind of duties or let dogs run in there to keep watch during the night. And while I was there, the one of the doors of one of the shacks flew open and a bunch of Koreans came screaming out and hollering and they were chasing one Korean. And he ran to the barbed wire fence and started to climb it. And the crowd grabbed him, pulled him down, and were beating and pummeling him. Now, this happened in, like, the wink of an eye. But in that wink of an eye, the word went out quick, something's happening, and our ready force assembled and ran inside, and they broke it up. And the guy was really badly beaten. And I was told later that, oh, occasionally they think they have found a spy that we put in there, or they think that someone is a turncoat, and they eliminate him if they possibly can. And so that apparently was what I witnessed when I saw this altercation with people running after someone and him trying to climb the barbed wire and you know, barehanded and so forth. So that was just a little excitement during that trip.
Yeah. So, what? How many POWs do you know per enclosed area?
No, I really, I don't have any definite statistics on how many were in a compound mm-hmm. or how many were in a hut. I honestly don't remember that. But I do remember the 50,000 number as
yes.
being mm-hmm. the totality of it. And in 1980, on leave from the University of Texas at El Paso, I was the manager of international human resource programs for Motorola Corporation. And I went around to just a large number of companies doing professorial things, giving seminars and workshops and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And as it would happen, when I got to Motorola Korea, they had set up a retreat to what they told me would be a vacation island. And we flew to Kojido, where the Korean Airlines had built a 20-story hotel for tourists. And so I actually was back on Kojido all of that time later, and instead of being a prison camp, it was being touted as a wonderful vacation spot for people with money.
That's what you call an upgrade.
Boy, I'll say. That was interesting.
Yeah, that's how times change. But really a very intriguing story about the potential internal issues inside a POW camp.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad that you decided to throw that in. We, Tom, had been discussing your participation in the Follow Me exercise down south. Can you kind of take us on after your
sure.
your kind of harrowing visit to Bourbon Street?
Right. Well, actually, the harrowing part was all over then, aside
Thank
from
God.
The Jeep ride all the way back.
Right.
We had stop-off places. I remember it was then Camp Stewart, Georgia, was one place we stopped. And as I mentioned earlier, Eglin Air Force Base was another stop. And when the maneuver was over, we gave our reports. People did briefings to the higher-ranking officers. And then we left Slidell in Lake Charles, Louisiana, and I think they were glad to see us go, but at the same time, they missed the money that the troops had poured into the area just in buying sundries and things like that. And we wended our way back to Fort Bragg. And when we got back to Bragg, as I remember, we had put roughly 5,000 miles on the Jeep that I was driving in. So that was a lot of wear and tear on both the Jeep and us, and we had to get things back in shape in the motor pool and so on.
You mentioned, Tom, that this was an Army-wide, I mean, a third this Army, was a third Army-wide.
This was
exercise.
A third Army-wide exercise.
And so how many, just guesstimating, how many folks, what might we be talking about having been mobilized for this?
Oh, boy, I would have to guess, but I know we had two division-sized forces. So let's say around 30,000 people.
That's just massive.
Yes, it is.
Wow, okay.
This was a big deal for that particular time. And it was a time when the Army was now starting to wind down again. The Korean armistice had been signed. We knew we were going to leave 30,000 or 40,000 troops in Korea for a while, but we knew that the monies that Congress would appropriate were going to start shrinking because the war was over.
Mm-hmm.
They started talking about a reduction in force, so these things were bubbling in the air. And when I got back, of all things, I was surprised because I found that I had been assigned now to 18th Airborne Corps Artillery. I had been in a battalion as a battery commander, and then I was when the captain came in, I became an executive officer, which is the first lieutenant slot. Then I went on Follow Me.
Mm-hmm.
I came back, and I was only in that executive officer's slot for a relatively short period of time, maybe 60 days or something like that. And I was assigned as the assistant S-3 of 18th Airborne Corps Artillery, which was quite a move up. At the same time, my old general, General Johnson, had come back from Korea, and he had become the deputy commanding general of 3rd Army. And he and I occasionally wrote to one another.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew where he was and what he was doing and so on, and he knew where I was. So I was up now as the assistant S-3. Since I was at 18th Airborne Corps, I thought I had better get to be airborne pretty quick. And so I put in for jump school. And in those days, the division had its own jump school, although the main Army jump school was at Fort Benning.
Mm-hmm.
And since we had one at, we had the 82nd Airborne Division right there on Fort Bragg, why, I was selected to go to the Fort Bragg Airborne School. And so on a Friday, I was sitting at my desk in the Airborne Corps Artillery doing assistant S-3 work, which is operations officer's work. I got a phone call, and they said, Lieutenant, report on Monday morning for airborne training at the 82nd. Now, most people who went to airborne training got 2 weeks of pre-BAT, which is pre-basic airborne training. I did not have that.
What's involved in pre-BAT?
It's all physical conditioning.
Oh, right.
Running exercises, push-ups, doing all kinds of physical things to get ready.
Yeah.
So I've been sitting behind a desk now for 60 days. I get the call. Off I go on Monday morning. And it's, I find that I'm not going to get pre-BAT. I'm going right into airborne training. And it's interesting. There were three of us who were officers in this class. So we were told to remove our officer insignia so that we would be, how shall I say, neither fish nor fowl. The NCOs who ran the school were really rugged guys, and the Army didn't want some sergeant hollering at a captain or a lieutenant or a major because that would be unseemly, yet they didn't want the captain or the lieutenant or the major not to do the same thing that all the troops do. That would be unseemly, so we removed all of our brass insignias and so on, and just joined the group. And the group were mostly 18 years old. I was an old man of 24. And the first thing we did was start on a 3-mile run. And we finished that up with PT. It was a rather rude awakening. And there was myself and a captain and a major. We sort of clung together for a while. But in the middle of the 3-mile run, the major fell down and hit his head and lost consciousness. And so they called a vehicle and took him away. And I never saw him again. He did not join the class again. And the rest of us, the other guy and I, we went through with the troops. And occasionally, if we faltered in our run, the sergeant, the NCO, they were called black hats because they wore black baseball caps to differentiate them as the cadre for the jump school.
Mm-hmm.
If you can imagine a platoon running, and I'm at the front of the platoon, and at the end of the 2nd mile, I have sort of drifted all the way back to the rear of the platoon because I couldn't breathe and my eyes were watering, and I'm running as fast as I could, and the sergeant diabolically would say, column left, column left, column left, and he would make the platoon turn right around and come right back in behind me, and suddenly I'd be in the front of the platoon. And when he did that twice, the third time, one of those 18-year-olds, remember, that meant they had to run more distance.
Sure, right.
The 18-year-old was saying something like, please, Lieutenant, keep up. I couldn't blame him. But I managed to get through it, and it was in the summertime,
mm-hmm.
and Fort Bragg can get very, very hot. This was in July of 1955, and it was very, very hot. And so that was the end of that day, and the next day there was more of that, and then they began to show us how chutes were packed. Then they showed us these wooden mock-ups of airplanes, and we would get in them, and they taught us how to make a parachute landing fall, a PLF,
mm-hmm.
so that you didn't break your legs or ankles and so on. And that was just a four-foot jump into sand pits, and they taught us the proper positions and so forth. And then as time went on, we worked our way up to the 34-foot tower, which was a horror for everybody the first time, because you climbed this wooden tower, 34 feet high. It had a door that resembled the door of an aircraft. You put on a harness that was attached to wires up over your head outside of this tower, and the harness wires ran all the way down to the end of a field. And at the command from the NCO, you would leap out of that door and assume the proper position for your airborne escape from the plane, and then you would drop the length of these canvas lines, these risers that you were on, which 34 feet, you probably dropped 10 feet, and that jerked you then,
mm-hmm.
Just as a real parachute opening was supposed to do, and then you zipped down by gravity down that long wire until the end, where you did a parachute landing fall. And at the bottom of the tower, there was an NCO sitting in what reminded me of a lifeguard's chair. It was a raised chair, tilted back, and he would watch you make your exit. And if he deemed your exit poor, you immediately went right back and did it again. And you did it again and again and again until he deemed that your exit was perfect. So you got to jump out of the tower a few times. And each time it was as bad as the first time. And only once or twice would someone get up there and then refuse to jump. And he would be sent back down again.
Uh-huh.
If they couldn't push him out, you know, if they really couldn't make him, if he were coming apart, sweating and laying down or something, they would get him down, and then he would be dismissed from the school, but they made the dismissal very ignominious. He would be marched in front of the guys who were going on, and it would be obvious to everyone that he was cowardly and didn't have the stuff to be airborne, and off he would go.
Did you actually witness that happening
just
to someone?
One. Yeah.
Yeah. What was your vantage point on that?
I was just one of the guys standing in the ranks as he went by.
Was there, like, hooting and hollering and jeering at him, or was
not
it just
from,
quiet?
Not from the ranks, just from the NCOs. They
yeah.
would be talking to us, telling us not to be like this. This is what weakness looks like, and this guy is an airborne material. He'll never be a trooper. He's a leg. That was one of the worst insults you could say, was a leg, because legs were non-paratroopers. Have you heard that?
That they were infantry, essentially.
Yeah, well, anyone who was a non-paratrooper is a leg.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And they would, and when you heard that, you knew that, ooh, that was really derogatory.
That was a
leg.
Slam.
Ooh, you didn't want to be that.
That was
so
a slam.
That school lasted 2 weeks, and at Fort Benning, they had a 200-foot tower that you actually got hauled up in, but we didn't have any tower. So we went from the 34-foot tower to an airplane. And
nice.
you jumped out of the airplane in the morning, and then they made you jump again in the afternoon, because they had found over time that if you jumped once in the morning and then you didn't jump again until the next day,
uh-huh.
some people got very frightened about
mm-hmm.
the second jump. Whereas if you jumped in the morning, it's so exhilarating. When you land on the ground, you feel 10 feet tall. It's a terrific jolt of adrenaline. And before that could wear off too much, why, that afternoon they'd have you back in the plane to make another jump. And once you've done it twice, you say, okay, well, I know how to do it, and I lived, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So I graduated from jump school, and that was the two-week part of the course. Two or 3 weeks.
How many actual jumps did you have to do in order to graduate?
In order to graduate, you had to do 3 jumps.
Okay.
And then you went to your unit. So I did the jumps was back there a week, and I got notification that they were going to have the prop blast ceremony on a certain evening, and I was supposed to leave on leave the next day, but of course you have to go to the prop blast ceremony or your wings aren't official.
Okay.
And the prop blast was put on by the division, the airborne division, and it's for the new guys who just got their wings. And it was quite elaborate. It was an elaborate drinking ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
It was fraternity stuff. They actually had a mock-up of a fuselage in this building near the officers' club, and you got in there and you jumped out and landed on the floor and did a parachute landing fall, and then they would give you these horrible concoctions that some idiot would dream up, like scotch and bourbon and slow gin, and then you would drink it as they would bang the table hollering, airborne, airborne, and stuff like that. And many people, well, all of us, frankly, it didn't end until everybody was knee-walking, falling down drunk. That was the capper.
And you were supposed to go on leave?
I did not go on leave the next day. I could not get out of bed the next day until late in the afternoon. I was so damn sick.
Oh, God.
But that was, and you had to do that.
Mm-hmm.
That was just part of the ritual. It stopped many years later. I followed this just by reading the newspaper. It stopped many years later when a young lad at the prop blast drowned in his own vomit at a table, and no one had noticed that was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And his parents finally found out what had actually happened to him, and that was the end of that kind of prop blast as far as I knew from reading the paper, and that
mm-hmm.
was back in 1980 sometime.
All right.
So we got the prop blast certificate, mm-hmm. and back to my desk as the assistant S3. And then General Johnson came on an inspection tour, since he was the deputy commanding general of Third Army, mm-hmm. and Fort Bragg was in Third Army.
Was this an announced tour?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, this was a formal tour.
Mm-hmm.
And he requested that his old aide-de-camp be assigned to him for that day to accompany him.
Yep.
And so I got the phone call and said, General Johnson's coming and he wants you to go with him. And so I just had a wonderful day and I formally met the commanding general, the lieutenant general. I think at that time it was T.J.H. Trapnell. And I just went around with the general. In other words, I had no duties, actually. I just was his aide for the day. And we had a chance to reminisce. And it was just a wonderful day.
Mm-hmm. How did he seem to you?
He seemed like he had put back a little weight. But he was a charming guy. He
mm-hmm.
was just he was a sweet guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really nice.
Good.
So I had that wonderful day, and let's see, that was sometime in the late fall, it was around Christmas time or something, somewhere around there. And after the general left, very shortly, 3 days, a week, 10 days, something like that, I got a set of orders, and I became the assistant G3 at Headquarters 18th Airborne Corps. And I was assigned, the G3 was a general officer's slot, but the officer in it, a fellow named Smith, was a full colonel at the time. He had not gotten his star yet, but the word was it was on the way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was brought up from Corps Artillery to Corps, and since he wasn't officially allowed an aide, I became his administrative assistant. So I had an office outside of his office, and I did what an aide does, the very same thing, make sure that everything runs smoothly so that he can think about big things and didn't worry about little things.
Mm-hmm. And this is in operations.
Yeah, the G3 is the operations officer.
And so what kinds of things would you be involved in? Exercise planning or review? Sure.
You know, just the day-to-day operational planning for the 82nd Airborne, the 101st Airborne, the 187th Regiment, just the things that it takes to run a Corps headquarters and deal with the divisions. And I did mostly the administrative paperwork. We had action officers who were generally lieutenant colonels and majors, and they would be doing the action things, writing plans, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And as a first lieutenant, I just made sure that everything was done on time, was in order, that the colonel got to sign it, that the appropriate copies went to the Department of the Army, that the appropriate commanders got the word of what the three was thinking about, and that Lieutenant General Trapnell had the stuff that the G3 wanted to go to him and things like that. So it was really nice. Once again, I was seeing the Army from sort of the top end of the operation, and I found it much to my liking. I got a kick out of doing that.
And you and it's interesting because you were kind of a detail man, it sounds like, but you also were getting the breadth of vision.
Yes, and I am not a detailed person.
Are you not?
At all. I am a big picture person.
Mm-hmm.
So I really, really, really had to focus because I do not like minutia. When I got to a position where I had a deputy, it was always someone who was detail-oriented because I'm not. So it was sort of a behavioral flex for me to do that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I've often wondered, why did I get selected to move from a battery to division artillery to Corps artillery to the Corps? How did I do that? I don't know. I've often wondered if General Johnson might not have played a role somewhere in that kind of thing. But there I am, and I'm doing that duty, and everything is wonderful. And in September of 1956, I get a set of orders, and I've been selected to go to the first Field Artillery Surface-to-Surface Missile Battery Officers Course, number one. We called it FASMBOC, for Field Artillery Surface-to-Surface Missile Battery Officer, FASMBOC. And there were 195 or 185 in the group.
Mm-hmm.
They were all regular Army officers. The majority were West Point. They obviously were all artillerymen, and this was going to be at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. It was going to be a year long, actually 10 months long, but it was called a year course.
Right.
And it was the first shot of the Army trying to have a course between the basic officer course, or the OCS course, and the advanced course, which provides instruction for officers to deal with jobs at the higher levels, at the division level and corps level, things like that. So this was going to be, we have missiles being introduced into the Army, I should say, and we need people who can deal with that, and so they formed this first course, and we were the guinea pigs who were going to go through the course. And it was a terrific course. It was at Fort Sill. Fort Sill had just built Snow Hall, an educational building. And Snow Hall was just the latest in military design, I should say, with classrooms, and everything looked modern and up-to-date. They had green boards and white boards, and, you know, blackboards were the thing before.
Right.
This was up there, and they had various kinds of projectors in the back of the room to put up on screens and so forth. So we thought that was really fancy. And there were, as I say, about 185, 195 of us. And we started out, and lo and behold, we had 500 hours more of gunnery. So when that course was over, I had roughly 1,000 hours of formal classroom instruction in artillery gunnery. And that was pretty neat. We also had motors where we looked at the prime movers for all of our artillery, because lo and behold, along with the missiles, they had introduced the rocket cannon, which was the 280, 240 or 280. Anyhow, it was a cannon that was designed to fire artillery small nuke shells, small atomic shells. And it had a prime mover at each end, just like a hook and ladder fire truck has steering at both ends. So this had a prime mover at both ends, and it fired this huge shell that contained an atomic bomb, so to speak.
Did it have a nickname? Was this like the...
Yes, it did, and I forget what it was.
Was it Long John or something?
No. There was a rocket called the Long John.
Oh, okay, the rocket.
And this gun had a nickname, too, and I don't remember what it was. But they brought that out for us to look at, and we studied the gunnery of that thing. And it was pretty, the gunnery is pretty much the same. It fired a long way, so you worried about Coriolis effect and all of the things that you worry about in heavy artillery. And you also realize that it took just days to get that thing from point A to point B and then into position and then set up for firing. So it was no swift kind of mover. We used to say the artillery moves, shoots, and communicates. Well, this one, we moved slowly and shot and communicated. And so that really didn't last very long in the Army. But at the same time, we were studying the first Army rockets, the Redstone, I think, was one of them, and so forth. And it was a nice chance to meet 185 of your contemporaries who were mostly all regular Army officers and get to know them. For 10 months, you lived together. We had a test every week. Every week, they could let you know what your class standing was. It was not an easy kind of a course. They really worked us over in terms of learn this stuff. We went out on the ranges a lot and fired live artillery rounds. We watched demonstrations. We did all of the things designed to get us as up to speed as you possibly could be for the new Army, which was going to be full of missiles for the artillery.
Did they give you training in, for example, health physics or how to survive a nuclear battlefield and that kind of thing?
Well, one of the things we had to do was to get our prefix 5, and a prefix 5 in the Army was nuclear weapons officer, which meant that we studied and then took tests on how to fire a nuclear weapon to get the appropriate damage in the appropriate place without contaminating our own troops or hurting our own troops and so on. So we had all kinds of templates and books with various tables and so forth, so that theoretically, if the commander said, the Russians are coming through the Fulda Gap, and here they are, and here they are, we could plan nuclear fires that would close it off. And so the prefix 5 course within that 10-month course was a real detailed, the kind of thing I hate, with all of the looking up of various numbers and calculations and so forth. And you had better pass it. And I saw more than one person, while we're waiting outside to go in for an exam, walk into the latrine and come back out looking white as a sheet and wiping their mouth. And you know that they had just thrown it all up. And I was scared to death, too, because I've never thought of myself as being wonderful with minutiae and numbers, but just the pressure. I passed that all right and got my prefix 5. And so then I had a prefix 5 And, of course, I had a prefix 9, which I remember as being your parachutist. And we were getting these prefixes stuck on our MOSs because of this course. So the course is over now.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, can I just one more question,
yeah.
Tom, before you go on? You said that this, in addition to the curriculum, also provided you with opportunity to meet other men, essentially in your cohort.
Yes, and also some foreign officers.
Okay, that was what I was going to ask. Were there any
right.
non-U.S.
Well, for
personnel?
Instance, we had two Pakistani officers. One was named Maqbool Mohammed, and both of these officers, by the way, had perfect British accents.
Mm-hmm.
Maqbool Mohammed was the one I remember so well, and when he told me his name, I said, wow, you know, because they kind of, it's a guttural, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, could I just call you Reggie?
Nice.
And he smiled, but I don't know if he really got that, but he smiled.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a major in the Pakistani Army, and there was a captain with him whose name I don't remember because it wasn't so startlingly different. And so those two, we became relatively close because they were in our platoon, and we invited them to social parties and, you know, things.
Sure.
They were all always included. Now, the Army at that time had, because of the number of foreign troops we were training at Fort Sill, they had a rule that foreign troops, that English was not their first language. For instance, Canadians didn't have to do this, but
mm-hmm.
foreign troops that didn't have that were supposed to get an extra hour to take exams. They were supposed to come to an exam an hour in advance, and they would be given the exam to start then. So if an exam was a two-hour exam, they would get 3 hours. Well, Reggie and the other fellow...
Mm-hmm.
One day we come in to take the exam, and there they were sitting there all alone. There were no papers on their desk or anything. And we come in, and in came the proctor who was going to give the exam. And Reggie, Major Maqbool Mohammed, stood up and said to him something like, sir, we have been here for an hour. No one has been here at all with us. What did you expect us to do? Contemplate? So he let it be known that he was upset. And, of course, the proctor apologized profusely and so forth. And it really wasn't necessary for those two guys. English wasn't their first language. It was Urdu. But they had grown up speaking English with the British Raj, you know, and the first commandant of the Pakistani Military Academy was a brigadier general in the English Army,
mm-hmm.
who later I had a chance to meet and attend these dining-in nights with, where we all wore our rigs and our full uniforms and gongs and everything.
Was that in Washington? Or
no, that was in San Francisco.
Oh, mm-hmm.
He was a marvelous guy. But my point is, mm-hmm. they were as English as could be.
Yes, I absolutely.
And mm-hmm. they were rather upset with that.
Yeah.
So those were the two foreigners that I remember specifically. I actually have the graduation booklet and list over in my bookcase. But
fabulous.
Take my word for it. Those were the two that I remembered.
Okay.
And I've often wondered right now, talking about Pakistan and all of this, I wonder if Reggie and his compatriot are still alive or still remember Snow Hall and the first field artillery surface-to-surface missile battery officers course number one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we graduated. It's June. And
of 57?
This, let me just look and let's see. 57, right.
Okay.
I went September 56 and in July 57 I had my new assignment.
Mm-hmm.
And now here I am. I'm a regular Army officer, paratrooper, who has just finished a year course on missiles. Guess where I am assigned? Guadalcanal zone in the Caribbean, where all of my friends are going to Europe to be up against the Russians and the Cold War, and some of the others are going to Hawaii, and I'm going to Panama. I was literally crushed. There were just two of us out of the class that got assigned to Panama. I wondered, what the hell are they doing? There was no airborne in Panama.
There
are no missiles in Panama. There's no artillery in Panama. There's just air defense. And I vehemently denied having anything to do with air defense artillery. I said, you know, that's not me. I'm an artilleryman, a mud gunner. But my orders were to Panama. And so I went to Panama. And I joined the 903rd AAA Battalion. You want to hear a little bit about Panama?
I sure do, actually. I really am interested in the unit designation, first of all. 903 AAA Battalion.
Yeah. So, USAR Carib. USARCARIB.
And that's that battalion apparently was air defense, is that right?
Yes, it was.
Okay, that would be the AAA.
Here's the story. There was an air defense group down there.
Okay.
The 903rd and the 764th.
Okay.
Were the two. And one battalion was on one side of the canal, and one battalion was on the other side of the canal. Remember, people don't realize this, but the Panama Canal actually runs just about north and south. It doesn't run east and west because of the bend in the peninsula. So that Panama, when it bends coming off Costa Rica before it gets to Colombia, actually runs in a way that the canal is cut through it, and it's practically north and south. So one side was by up in the northern end, and that was called the eastern side, and the other side was the western side. Okay, so I arrive, and I arrive by plane, and I'm with a major and the other captain, I mean the other lieutenant who was assigned with me, and myself. When we arrive, we are met by a host, because in that particular part of the world, they had this formal deal where you would have a sponsor. When you arrived, some officer met you, and it was his job to welcome you and get you settled into your quarters and make you feel as a part of the unit.
Right? Nice.
And, you know,
I mean, that's nice.
Yes, it was.
I don't think I've ever heard of this before.
Right. And when it was a family coming in, we would actually stock the refrigerator with a couple of days' worth of food so that they didn't have anything to worry about.
Brilliant.
We would draw the pots and pans and silverware for the quarters and so on. But as a bachelor, I was met by an officer, and the other two fellows had, you know, we shared this guy since we were coming down as bachelors. And we were taken over to the BOQ, and we were told tonight there was going to be a Bienvenida Despedida party, which you will attend. Bienvenida Despedida is welcome and farewell.
Okay.
So the party was to welcome the new guys and say goodbye to the people who were leaving. And it would be at the officers' club, and it would be at 1900 hours, and you would be in this uniform and be there. Yes, sir. So that's what we did. And we get to the party, and I'll tell you some personal stuff here because I get a kick out of it, and it is Army stuff.
Sure.
We get to the party, and remember, I'm a bachelor, 25, I guess, and my girl is back in Fort, I had been dating a colonel's daughter back in Fort Sill, and so I'm a bachelor down there, freshly arrived, and I'm wearing a dress white uniform and so forth. And the party starts and the drinking begins, and I'm a I was relatively a shy person in person. Interpersonally, it took me a little while to warm up and say hello and things like that.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So we're at this big table and we're dining and drinking and so forth and so on, and a woman comes over and says to me, in a German accent, you are the new officer here. I want you to dance with me.
This is like something from a spy training film.
Yeah,
don't let this
exactly.
happen to you.
Yeah, I thought about that.
with the foreign accent and everything.
I looked at her and I thought, no, I don't know anybody. I don't know you. You're not supposed to ask me. I'm supposed to ask you. And besides, you're much older. And so I told her, no, I don't dance. I'm terribly sorry. I don't want to dance. So she goes off in a huff, and the people at the table say, don't you know that's the adjutant's wife? That's whatever her name was. She was a German national that he had married when he was in Germany. Don't you know that's the adjutant's wife? I said, no, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I just got off the plane.
Yeah, they said, well, you'll get to know him because you're going to be assigned here. And, you know, this is the group headquarters. You're going to be assigned here, and you're going to get to see him every day. Well, it isn't 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 minutes later, she's back again, and she has another woman with her. And she says, I want you to dance with Mrs. So-and-so. I thought this was utterly unbelievable. And I didn't dance with her. I better not dance with whoever that
right.
is.
Right. This is a
right.
Hobson's choice.
This is a trap. So I said, I'm terribly sorry. I hurt my leg. I don't feel well. I don't know how to dance. And she says, whew, and big huff. And she marches off with the woman in tow. Well, the woman in tow turned out to be the group commander's wife. And there I am, the new guy in his dress white uniform who has just stepped in it right up to his ears. And I was told that, boy, you're going to know about this. I learned later that Panama was sort of a dumping ground for has-beens or never-weres. And I was a regular Army officer sent into a battalion that didn't have any. They didn't have any paratroopers either. It was a backwater. Okay, mm-hmm. The party is over. I have been disgraced. The next morning, I get my orders, and guess what? I'm not assigned there. My orders have been changed. I am now going to be assigned to the Atlantic side, which is the Siberia of Panama. So I'm going to be sent to Fort William D. Davis, which was where the battalion headquarters was, and I would be assigned to a battery. Well, I packed my gear up and got in the Jeep and drove the 50 miles across the isthmus and reported into the battalion commander. Now, once again, I learned shortly thereafter that the troops used to nudge one another and go wink, wink when the battalion commander did not appear for 3 or 4 days at a time, and they would say, oh, I see the old man has the flu, and then they would all giggle and say, yeah, the whiskey flu.
Right.
He would go on benders. Mm-hmm. Well, I report to this colonel. He's a southerner. He is obviously out of shape and so forth, and he had my records in front of him, and he told me, he said, we had another regular Army officer here, Shepard. He moved on to Army. Now, Army was over at Fort Amador on the Isthmus of Panama. So this other regular had been a West Pointer who had very quickly gotten out of that cesspool.
Right. Mm-hmm.
He said, we had another regular, and he's up at Army now. And then he said to me, and this is a quote, are you prejudiced against, and I said, sir? He said, are you prejudiced against niggers? No, sir. I'd never been asked a question like that in my life. He said, well, good, because you're going to work in C Battery for Captain Andy. And Andy is a big black buck. Yes, sir. So I get assigned to Captain Andy. And he is actually Captain Anderson. And he is one fantastic. He's about 6'2 or 3. And he has a bravura presentation of himself and a deep voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I report into him. And we chat for a little bit. And I think, this is a great guy. I'm going to learn a lot from this guy. He's had imagine being a captain in 1957. That was pretty damn good and pretty damn rare.
Very rare, I would think.
So Captain Anderson.
Do you know his first name? Do you remember his first name?
No, primarily because behind his back he was always Captain Andy.
Was that kind of a slur?
No.
It wasn't a reference to...
That was in short for Anderson.
Sure.
And Captain, primarily because he demanded it.
Right, you better.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to say something like, I may not be able to fly a rocket ship, but I can command a battery. And my God, he was right. He was really something. And so I became his executive officer. And the thing that really sticks out is this unit was a 75-millimeter anti-aircraft gun battery. I didn't have any training in anything like that. This was a radar-directed, rapid-firing 75-millimeter gun, which isn't a big thing at all, but it put out a lot of rounds and was for low-level aircraft, low-level propeller-driven aircraft, actually. And so that's where I was assigned. And I watched and learned a lot from Captain Andy. And
What kinds of things did you learn from him?
How to deal with troops.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about it, I really had not been with troops since 60 days after I graduated from OCS. I had moved immediately to a battalion staff, then a division staff, then back to a battalion, and immediately back to a corps artillery staff, and then to a corps staff, and then to school. And now here I was down with the troops, walk into the barracks and do barracks inspections and things like that. And I watched how Andy dealt with the troops, how he humanized himself and made himself such that people wanted to do what he wanted them to do. And not through fear, but that was always in the background. You knew that he could be set off, and you didn't want that to ever happen. He was quite a character.
He sounds amazing. Just his survivorship.
Right. He told stories about coming up in the Second World War and after the war was over and all kinds of... He told some wonderful stories that I don't think belong here, but they're really great.
Sure.
And I learned a lot. And his wife and his family had a company. This was an accompanied tour. It was generally 3 years when you went there. So you got a set of quarters on the military base. You didn't live off base then, and
so he had children there.
Yeah.
Do you remember them?
Not a bit. I just know he had a couple of kids.
Do you remember his wife?
I remember his wife quite well, and that is because we jump ahead a little bit in time.
Sure.
I had been there 8 months, 10 months, something like that, and I'm writing to my girl back in Oklahoma and sending her tape letters, and she's sending me tape letters, and I'm once in a while dating a local American girl from the Canal Zone.
Mm-hmm.
The Canal Zoners. I met Canal Zoners who were fourth generation. Fourth, not third, fourth generation. Their great grandfathers had been digging the canal and every member of the family had stayed and worked on the canal.
Somebody should do a project on that.
It was a
inbred,
super American. They were more American than American.
Right, exactly.
And they were living in a thing 55 miles wide, long, and 5 miles wide, that was this little America, and they were socialist to the core.
Really?
Absolutely. The gas stations were run by the government. The commissary was run by the government. The clothing store was run by the government. The Christmas trees were delivered by the government. The health care was done by the government. Everything was U.S. government controlled, and a major general of the army was the governor. It was amazing.
Wow.
They had grown up totally in a socialistic setting. There were no entrepreneurs. Nothing.
But they were, as you say...
They were super Americans because they looked down on the Panamanians.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, there were two standards of pay, gold standard, silver standard. If you were an American, you were on the gold standard, you got this many dollars per hour or month. If you were Panamanian, you were on the silver standard, and you got paid better than any Panamanian out in Panama, but you were still on a different level than were the Americans.
This sounds like, early 20th century British colons, sitting in somewhere in India.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Very
they
similar.
They had their own clubs.
Yeah.
Beautiful clubs. Their own bowling alleys, as I say, their own service stations, their own medics. I remember trying to buy some nails at the Pan Canal Commissary.
Mm-hmm.
And first I went and looked at the nails. Then when I selected the nails I want, I went back to a sort of a cage-like affair and told them what I wanted, and they gave me a slip of paper, and I took that back to the nails and gave that to someone who then took the nails out and put them in the bag, and then they gave me the nails with another slip that I took back to another cage, and that's where I paid for the nails.
That sounds like Eastern Europe to me.
It was
before the wall.
Weird.
Yeah.
You couldn't buy gasoline on Sunday before a certain hour,
right,
or after a certain hour because all the stations were closed.
But they were all government run.
Right.
Government meaning the government of the Canal Zone, or
the government of Canal Zone, which is the U.S. government.
Sure. Right.
A particular kind of a dress, Laura, you would find out when the shipments were arriving. And then you would race there because there might not be three numbers in your size. So you would grab your size, if you were lucky, or if four people had gotten there ahead of you, you would have to wait until the next time.
Yeah.
And no matter what party you went to, you knew you were going to meet someone wearing the same dress and shoes because the limitations on what was available were such that that's just the way it was.
How interesting. I mean, there must have been some very bizarre pecking order stuff going on there.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. You wouldn't believe
it. Intense. Very intense.
The highest pecking order was the Pan Canal pilot. The Pan Canal pilot who piloted the ships through the canal were the highest paid, and the only person paid higher than them was this lawyer who was sort of the factotum of the canal, and he was generally a major general in the army who had a law degree sometimes or sometimes not. But that was the only guy higher than you if you were a Pan Canal pilot. That was like being an astronaut as far as they were concerned.
Right. Wow.
And then the pecking order went down from there, like the mule driver. These were electric. They would be above the guy who put the lines on the ship. But above the mule driver would be the guy in the control tower who controlled the locked gates and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, I met fourth generation, but second and third generation were commonplace, absolutely commonplace.
Wow.
And every so often, and I forget exactly how long they had to wait, but they were then entitled to 2 months paid leave back in the States. And most of them would take that and go back and stock up on stuff.
Because they buy everything.
They would buy stuff and bring it back in because you could get it in without duty if you were So there I was, and I've been there 8 or 10 months, and I got a leave to fly back to the States.
Mm-hmm.
And I had met some Navy pilots in one of the clubs. The Navy were training navigators for their P-2V-4 submarine chasers. Those were twin-engine aircraft. Today they're on the P-3 Orion. Back then it was the P-2V-4, and it was twin-engine, and the idea was it had this magnetic anomaly boom on the back, and if they flew over a submarine, it would make the dials jump inside the airplane, and they would know a submarine was around, and they could track it and so on. So they had to train their navigators, and they came out of Hutchinson, Kansas, and my friends told me, hey, anytime you want to hitchhike back to the States, we'll fly you back to Hutchinson, and that was very close to Fort Sill.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Relatively close.
Uh-huh.
And they said, if you want to go, why, just let me know.
Uh-huh.
So one time, a friend of mine, he was an infantry lieutenant, he and I decided we'd take leave together, and we would hitch a ride on the P-2V-4s, and so we went to the field and, you know, got on board, and they said, do you know how to use a parachute? And I had that crooked smile of the airborne trooper. I said, of course I do. Well, they showed me a chute that I had never seen before, and they showed me a square in the floor, and they said, we just lift out this hatch, and there was a hole right out of the airplane. I wondered, how the hell do you make a proper exit out of this thing?
Fold your arms?
You kneel, you sort of kneel in a crouch with your arm folded,
right,
and roll out of it. You fall down through it.
Wow.
I said, oh, let's hope we don't have to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
And the P-2V-4 had a large radome underneath,
mm-hmm,
like a, you know, like a saucer stuck underneath it.
Yes.
And the radome...
Under its main fuselage?
Yeah, under the main fuselage.
Uh-huh.
It was a big radome.
Yep.
And there was no radar in it. And it seemed that just before we took off, an unmarked truck drove out on the tarmac, mm-hmm, and unloaded several cases of booze into the radome. I said, wow, didn't know about that. So we take off, and there are something like 5 ensigns in the rear of the plane doing navigation problems, and there's one pilot up front. Another pilot is laying down on a bunk because he is really exhausted from his weekend down in Panama, and the pilot up there says to me, hey, do you want to sit up front and watch? I said, sure. So I go sit up front, and we start the flight, and we've been flying some time, and I look over, and the pilot is sound asleep. I mean, he is zonked. So in a panic, I shake him and say, you're asleep, you're asleep. And he looked up, and he gave me the dirtiest look, and then told me, of course he was asleep, and he used lots of scatological references to my brains. We were on automatic pilot, and he said, I'll wake up by the time we get to Dry Tortugas, and don't worry about it. So I sat there bug-eyed, thinking, nobody's flying this, except that guy who's asleep there.
And you're up in front.
And I'm sitting right alongside of him in the co-pilot's seat, and I don't know anything other than I'm looking at the sky. Well, sure enough, he wakes up by the time we get to the Dry Tortugas. He points it out to me,
mm-hmm,
and he said, we're going to land at the Marine Air Base because customs won't have a chance to get there before we get off again, and because the radome is full. And he said, as a matter of fact, if we crash landed, we wouldn't die in the crash. We would drown. So the plane lands, and sure enough, we're there. We refuel and do whatever he has to do, and mm-hmm, we take off again for Hutchinson, Kansas. And both officers' messes at the Marine base and at Hutchinson are happy to get some booze that only cost $2 a bottle or $1 and a quarter a bottle or something.
Sure.
And they said, okay, we'll pick you up. We fly the next trainees down on Monday morning. If you're here at 0800 hours or whatever time, we'll fly you back. So this is a Friday afternoon, and I get down to Fort Sill. Somehow, I don't remember whether I rented a car or what I did, but I got down to Fort Sill. I meet my girl, and we're trying to make up for 8 months away, and meeting all our friends, and we're over at the officers' club, and we're over at the officers' club, and we're over at the officers' club. And Sunday night, two of our friends tell us, "You make a perfect couple, you know that? Why don't you get married?" And I said, "Well, it's 6 o'clock on Sunday night, and I'm leaving tomorrow morning. How could I get married now?" And my girl said, "My grandfather is the undersheriff of Comanche County, and he could get us a judge right now." And I said,
"She's a problem solver."
I said, don't you need a blood test?" She said, "He could arrange that." Well, to make a long story short, this was at 6 o'clock. At 11 o'clock, I was in the chaplain's quarters on Fort Sill with the head chaplain, the undersheriff of Comanche County, my friend Charlie and his date, and my girl and me. And he says, "I now pronounce you man and wife." And the next morning, I was on a bomber flying, on a P-2V4 flying back to Panama, and I had a wedding ring on my finger, and I was saying, "I'm married. I'm married." It was really, really strange.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. When I landed in Panama, one of the gals I had been dating met me in her car,
right.
and she had a little lovely convertible thing, and we were driving across, and I said, "I have something to tell you. I got married." And that was the end of that relationship very quickly.
Right.
And this is all because of Captain Andy's wife that I wanted to mention. When I got back and I announced to my unit, "Hey, I got married over the weekend," why, there was a celebration and consternation at the same time. And I arranged for my wife to come down, and she came down. And Captain Andy's wife was going to have a little reception party for my wife.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my wife had been there something like 2 days. We had quarters assigned to us immediately. Furniture is supplied down there. You didn't bring your own furniture. Furniture was supplied. So it's furnished quarters. I am still stunned. Marriage was not what I had in mind, but I was married, and I'm stunned, and she's stunned, and she's just there for 2 days, and the captain's wife is going to give her a little reception on this third day or fourth day, something like that. And I go to work, and my wife gets the what I call them, the Montezuma's revenge, the stomach flu, the, "Oh, you're in Panama and you're not used to the water," or whatever it was. She gets deathly sick, and she calls me at the battery and said, I can't get out of bed, I'm so sick, I'm throwing up," and so forth. And so I rush over, and lo and behold, she is in a bad way. And I call over to the dispensary and say, "I'm bringing my wife over," and I take her over there, and they give her something for sort of a palliative for her stomach, and they tell me she's just got a bug, you know, she's only been here a couple of days, and put her back in bed, lots of fluids, and this will go away. And so I take her back, and by the time I get back to the battery, it's in the afternoon, and the word is out, Mrs. Anderson is really ticked at your wife. Why? Because she shunned her. She did not come to her own party. Is she prejudiced? Is she some kind of a prejudiced person? Oh, boy. You can imagine. That was so ridiculously stupid that I couldn't believe it. At the same time, I thought, what is Captain Anderson going to think if the woman he lives with says that lady is prejudiced and wouldn't come to a black person's house? Or, it was sticky. It was really, really bad. And it took quite a while to kind of get over that. So,
how did you try to nail it down with her and with him?
Well, first of all, Andy said something to the effect, I wanted to go in Apollo. He said, you don't want to see her,
Tom.
You know, you don't want to see her.
Yeah.
He said, let me take care of this. And I must have apologized 70 different ways over. Judy wrote a note talking about how ill she had been and how badly she felt when she recovered and how sorry she was. And so it took, Andy seemed to be okay. He said, hey, you know, a lot of people get tummy trouble when they get here, and that's the way it is. He said, my wife is just, that's the way she is. And so he was okay, and he understood. I felt, and I, you know, perception's reality, so that was my reality. He's okay. And he says, don't go near my wife. I'll take care of that and smooth it out. And so that's just the way it played for quite a while. And then another officer came in, and I was told, okay, now you're going to go and work for another captain in a battery next door.
Mm-hmm.
And he is Captain Joseph P.P. Bednarz. P.P. stands for Peter and Paul. He is Slavic descent. He is short, stupid, and an alcoholic, just as a lot of people were down there. I mean, they really were.
Mm-hmm.
So my time with Joseph P.P. Bednarz was really... if I came in with polished jump boots, it was, well, do you think you're back in that airborne outfit you come from? If I come in with unpolished boots, it was, I thought you regular Army guys were supposed to look good. And, you know, it was just terrible. He was, he didn't have college behind him. He had come up through the ranks. He was into alcohol, and the antipathy between us was relatively palpable. In the meantime, this colonel who had asked me if I was prejudiced, he was having more and more whiskey flus, and it was starting to seep up to Army that this was really happening. And so Army suddenly came down in full force with an IG and, you know, Inspector General and so forth.
Right.
And the colonel was relieved. And, boy, I thought, how wonderful. This guy was, he shouldn't have been commissioned. He was just literally a non-entity drunk. And the major, who was named Ostrom, actually sort of was running things because the colonel was incapacitated a great deal and so forth.
Right.
So it was a real noxious stew there. So when the IG came over, they interrogated all of the officers and asked us questions and so forth. And we were under oath and so forth and so on. And pretty soon the colonel was gone. Another guy was sent in to replace him, and the whole thing got shaken up. And lo and behold, after that inspection, I was reassigned to the good coast. I found myself over in the 764th, which then became the headquarters, and one of the battalions disappeared. It was deactivated. And there was only one battalion, and they sent in a regular Army lieutenant colonel to command it. And when I came in, I mean, for some reason, I was called over there. Now, you remember I'm a regular.
Yeah.
A new colonel came in, and he was a regular, and we had a major that I had met in Fort Sill. And he was going to be the S3, and he was a regular. So the group disappeared and became a battalion, and they had three regular officers up in the front office. I became the headquarters and headquarters battery commander. The major became the S3, And the new lieutenant colonel, of course, was the commanding officer. And he was a pistol. He was a West Pointer.
Mm-hmm.
He hated anti-aircraft artillery. He wanted to know, what the hell is this? he wanted a field artillery unit. And guess what? I was a field artilleryman, and the major was a field artilleryman. And this lieutenant colonel, this West Pointer, his name was Wendell Knowles, Wendell P. Knowles, and he was known as Wendy Knowles. Wendy managed to scrounge up 6 105 howitzers, which had been on the isthmus, and I think they had something to do with ceremonial use firing salutes or whatever. Maybe they had something to do with the infantry regiment that was there. I don't know where he got them. He got them. And he pulled them together, and he brought me and the major in, and he said, I'm going to make a provisional field artillery battery, and we're going to run field artillery problems, and we're going to teach these people what the artillery is all about, and so forth and so on, and I want you to set up a fire direction center, and we'll have firing practice, and so forth. So suddenly the lackadaisical, let's have another rum after work ethic just disappeared.
Yeah, sounds and like it, fresh air all the way around.
Boy, it was for me.
Yeah,
oh, it was for me. Mm-hmm. I had actually been thinking about getting out of the Army. I thought, this is so bad. I can't believe they've got all these people. I've never seen people like this before.
Yeah, they're like caricatures or something.
Yeah, they were like the dregs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Wendy Knowles came in, and now, he had some idiosyncrasies, believe
mm-hmm.
me.
mm-hmm.
Army, you saw Carib, Army was at Fort Amador, and that was several miles away. We were on Fort Clayton, and that was totally different. And the back of the fort was pretty much jungly. Matter of fact, it was jungle. And on days when Wendy knew that he was going to be wrestling around out in the jungle, he wore jodhpurs and riding boots.
Mm-hmm.
Remember I told you that generals used to be able to make their own uniform?
Right.
Well, Wendy figured, why not? Who's going to say anything? So he wore jodhpurs and riding boots, and he had a couple of horses, and he would ride his horses, and he had other idiosyncratic notions that harken back to the old Army, the one at which he was commissioned in from West Point and so on.
Meaning pre-World War II.
Yeah, pre-World War II.
Yeah.
So there we were with Wendy Knowles, and now, lo and behold, I'm on the good side. This Fort Clayton is, wow, I had a set of quarters. I had a maid. I had a wonderful maid from Jamaica who had an English accent, and wanted everybody to know she was not Panamanian, she was Jamaican.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a dog that I had named Colonel out of frustration with that drunk on the other side, and Colonel was a lovely dog,
mm-hmm.
and I had my new wife, and we were settling into the way things were supposed to be and looked better, and I was the headquarters battery commander, and our lovely maid, Sylvia, used to tell me, Lieutenant, I only have the dog to walk, and all my friends have the babies to walk. When are you going to have the baby? I don't know whether my wife was putting her up to it or whether my wife heard it, but after another 8 months went by, why, Sylvia had a baby carriage to push instead of just the dog to walk.
Mm-hmm.
And during this time, there was a transition. The battery, I should say, the S3, the major, he moved up to become the battalion executive officer because Major White left. He and the colonel did not really get along well, and so he left, and the major moved up, and so they needed an S3, and that is a generally senior captain's job.
Yes.
Or a junior major. Well, I was still a first lieutenant, but I was assigned as the S3.
You were still a what, I'm sorry?
I was still a first lieutenant just waiting to become captain. My promotion was, it was announced, it was in the records.
Okay.
But the date hadn't exactly happened yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so they announced, I'm going to be the S3, and then bang, I get promoted, and I'm a captain now.
Right.
And obviously, I am the junior captain. And obviously, there are five battery commanders who are senior to me. But I become the S3. And while I am the S3 and thinking, my God, this is a lot of responsibility, and here I am, and I interact directly with Wendy Knowles, and he is a pistol, and I've got to play this just right.
Mm-hmm.
I start getting headaches every day. By noontime, I have a headache that would kill a mule.
Because of the stress, or?
Yeah, it was pure nerves and stress. I wanted it. Everything had to be perfect. I was the S3, and I wanted to be perfect, and he had picked me, and I was junior to everybody, so that was so good of him, and I had a feather in my cap, and so I had to be good for him. And he calls me, and it says, you're going to get a new operations sergeant. And he tells me, Sergeant so-and-so, here's his records, and he said, I want you to look him over and let me know if you're going to accept him. He said, no, you should know right off, he used to be the battalion commander of this battalion.
The battalion commander?
He used to be the battalion commander of this battalion.
Oh, boy. Mm-hmm.
He said alcohol got him. He lost his commission. He was sent to Europe. He needs two more years in order to be able to retire. He's a sergeant. I think you might be able to make use of him. Look at his record and let me know.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, oh, my God, that's the last thing I want. Just prior to that, we had the provost marshal of the USAR Carib,
mm-hmm.
Lieutenant Colonel,
mm-hmm.
Provost marshal, on Friday afternoon when he left work, and Monday morning when he came to work, he was a sergeant first class in the same unit. It was called the RIF, the Reduction in Force. And they were told, many of them, look, you've got 19 years in and you're losing your commission. You want a retirement? You better stay as an enlisted man. If you don't, you're out. 19 years or 19 years and 10 months, it's not 20. So there was the provost marshal, now an SFC, and here was my operations sergeant coming in. He had commanded the unit, this battalion, when he was a lieutenant colonel. So I thought, oh, my God, this is terrible. I looked at his record, and I said, well, I've got to interview him. That's the given. I have to interview him.
Right.
So I interviewed him, and he came in, and I told him, be at ease. Sit down. I want to talk to you. I said, you know, I really don't like this. You commanded this unit. I'm the junior captain. We've got a new commander now. You're a sergeant. I understand some of the sergeants know you from back in the old days when you commanded this. And he told me, he said, Lieutenant, Captain. I was a captain then. He said, Captain, I will really work for you. I don't drink anymore. That's out the window. It ruined my career. It's ruined my life. I'm not going to let it ruin my retirement. I'm a real soldier. I know lots of things that are going on. I could be helpful to you, and I promise that I'll just do everything I can to make your job easier. So I thought, well, you know, the colonel, my colonel has probably sent him here for a reason. Maybe I ought to say, that's okay, let's work this out. I didn't think Wendy Knowles would send somebody in that he thought was going to be an obvious flop. And I figured maybe it's good business.
Mm-hmm.
Tell a sergeant, let you and I work together. I'll make sure you get your 2 years and your retirement, and you make sure that the S3 shop works well. Well, Laura, it turned out to be the most symbiotic, wonderful relationship I could have had. It was just 100% good for me. He would accompany me when I would go on inspections. He would accompany me driving the vehicle. We would pull into the area. I was the S3. I would get out. I would be greeted and chat and so forth. And then my sergeant would drift alongside and say, and he always used the third person, old Army style. He would say, "Does the captain think he should look over at the motor pool at the so-and-so?" And then I would turn and say, "I think I should look at the motor pool at the so-and-so," and go over there. And by God, I don't know how he knew, but he could ferret out discrepancies and problem areas that normally you don't want an inspector to see. And then I would make a note and say, "Well, this has to be done at a certain time." And then he would say something like, "Does the captain think he should blah, blah, blah?" And I would say, "I think I will go over and blah, blah, blah." And then I would do that. And it was a learning process that was absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, in some ways, it's almost storybook. I mean, you're actually being guided around by someone who...
Yeah, I had a mentor.
It's incredible.
No doubt. And you remember in those days, fraternization was absolutely frowned upon. But after I had been working with him for, I don't know, 6 months, 8 months, a year, something like that, I noticed that he had a tennis racket that he brought in to work. Now, this guy was 50 years old, or, probably 50, 52, and had been an alcoholic. And so now I see he's got a tennis racket. I said, "Do you play tennis?" He said, "Oh, yes, sir." He said, I love to play. That's how I get my exercise and so on. And I said, "Well, I like to play tennis. So maybe you and I could play tennis on one of the courts in the canal zone, you know, off the base."
Right.
And so we would go off the canal zone, and this 52-year-old guy would run me ragged.
No kidding.
He was good. He could stand in one place and make me run back
right.
and forth. So it was another lesson. How to play tennis better than you did before, and never make fun of an old guy because he can whip your ass. So we had a very nifty relationship.
Very interesting.
The end of this story is he came up for retirement, and he was moving back to Washington. He had a lot of friends in Washington, D.C., around the Pentagon and so forth. And I told him, I said, "Sarge, when I come back to the Pentagon, I'm certainly going to look you up, and we'll have a drink and talk about all the fun we had and so forth and so on." He said, "Yes, sir, that's wonderful." We shook hands, and he left. And a couple of years later, when I was back up there, I wanted to see him, and I found out he had died just, shortly before I got to see him again. Heart attack or something like that. So that was one of those...
Well,
bad endings, but
that's pretty
it was good in the sense that he did leave the Army not under a cloud. He felt he had contributed. He had been so helpful to a young wet-behind-the-ears officer. He had made more friends, and he got his retirement.
Did he give you a sense of how he had been able to kind of dig down deep, turn it around, and actually accept?
We did not go there other than for him that initial time to tell me that alcohol had ruined his career and his life, and he had gotten over it and left it, and that was it.
There's some serious grit there somewhere. Yeah.
Can you imagine what I thought was the stupidity of the Army to send him back to the unit that he had commanded?
Oh, yeah. Well, this felt like a disaster.
And how about the provost marshal reporting on Monday morning as a sergeant first class in the military police outfit there?
couldn't even move him somewhere else to do it, right?
It was, the rift was horrible. The Army was being downsized like you wouldn't believe.
And Tom, this was downsized not only against its own, obviously its own previous profile, but also relative to the other services, right? I mean, the Army was...
I did not track what the other services were doing, but the Air Force was on Panama. They had an Air Force, they had an air base there that they used, and the Army used it. The Air Force was being downsized. The Navy had an air base called Coco Solo, and that was closed up and eventually left to go into ruins and then turned over to the Panamanians. And that was a seaplane base, also land planes. But Coco Solo was a naval base, and that was let go. They closed the Jungle Warfare Training Center, where I got my Jungle Expert Certificate. They closed that down.
Can you tell me a little bit about that, the Jungle Warfare Training Center?
Yeah, that was at Fort Sherman, and it was some of the thickest rainforest in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And to get a Jungle Expert Certificate, we didn't get a tab like a ranger tab. We got a certificate. And the school wasn't 4 weeks long or 8 weeks long like rangers. This was 2 weeks.
Okay.
Subunits were sent to Fort Sherman, where we had a formal nice barracks and so on.
Uh-huh.
And at that time I was there, it was commanded by a major whose name goes right out of my head, but I can tell you about him a little bit later.
Okay.
But we're sent there on these two-week courses to become jungle experts. That is, we lived in the jungle and did jungle things and so forth for 2 weeks, and if you passed, you got this certificate, and you could wear a little sewn-on device on your breast pocket that was the Caribbean design. The Caribbean design is a sort of a sailing ship,
mm-hmm,
on a blue background, and it said Jungle Expert on top. And you could wear that on your fatigues while you were assigned to USAR Carib. When you left the Carib, you had to take that off. It wasn't recognized outside of United States Army Caribbean. So it was a thing to have while you were there, and the training was great. They had some wonderful NCOs, and Major Chester, his last name was Chester, was the commandant of the Jungle Warfare Training Center. When I went, the course was 2 weeks long, and first of all, you were introduced to the jungle and how you can live in the jungle on your own. They taught us what water vines look like and how to cut a water vine so that you could get a complete glass of water out of the water vine. They told us how many varieties of poisonous snakes there were and what they looked like.
Uh-huh.
And they showed us the bird-catching spiders. They showed us, they said the most dangerous thing in the jungle is alive, but it can't move. And that turned out to be the black thorn tree, sometimes called the black palm tree. And it grows literally with thorns that pop out about 3 inches in length.
Yeah.
And they are as hard as plastic. And
mm-hmm,
if you're running through the jungle in the dark, or if you are turning fast in the dark and you happen to hit black palm, those things go right into you, and it is indeed very, very painful. And, of course, it could, I mean, that would open up a wound, and then you could get infected and so forth and so on. So they had a zoo there where they had a lot of these snakes, so you could see them and identify them. The fer de lance, this is the fer de lance, and it poison is so-and-so, and this is the bushmaster, and its poison is oviparous or viviparous, and things like that.
After
you did that,
uh-huh,
and they showed you how you could get a drink of water, they taught you how to handle a machete. If you don't handle a machete right, you end up cutting your own leg.
Yes.
And mm-hmm, after they showed us how to handle a machete, and they said, all right, now you go here into the jungle and you try this out. And, of course, within 20 or 30 minutes, we had the medic come by and stitch up some people who didn't quite grasp the lesson. And literally, when you hit a vine or a tree that's very green and springy with a machete, if you don't hit it at the right angle, it just sort of goes spring right off in the opposite angle, and that's where your legs happen to be. So they taught us how to use a machete, how to sharpen a machete, how to find water. And then they showed us what we could eat in the jungle. and they were telling us that everything is edible. And Major Chester had one of the most tremendously well-thought-out training aids that I've ever seen. We were brought into a jungle clearing, and they had little bleachers, and we sat in the little bleachers. In front of us, there was a square about 10 feet by 10 feet by 10 feet, and it had these palm frond walls around it. A palm frond wall you make with bamboo, and then you weave palm frond leaves in and out. You can picture what I'm talking about. And it was about 6 or 7 feet high, 10 feet long, and it was three-sided. And we were sitting in these little bleachers. And the NCO came out and said, gentlemen, today we're going to invite you to dine in the jungle. You can live like a king in the jungle and be healthy and happy, blah, blah, blah. He had a nice patter. And then he said something like, behold, and the three palm frond walls fell to the ground. And there was a table fully set with food, and at the head of the table was a beautiful blonde who probably was 40 years old, and sitting next to her was a beautiful blonde who must have been 18 years old, and they were dining. They were eating crab and hearts of palm and drinking crystal clear water, and of course, they were Major Chester's wife and daughter, and they were dressed formally in gowns, and you know, our eyes bugged out. We were in the jungle, and there they were, and all this, and then the sergeant invited us to come down and look at the table, and he introduced us to the major's wife and his daughter, and then he explained that this dish that they're dining on is hearts of palm. Back in the States, you get this in a can, and it costs you $2. Here you get it in the jungle, and it costs you nothing. And he showed us how you got hearts of palm. And he said, and this is something snake meat. And you get that by killing this snake, and you skin it, and so forth. And this is manioc, and you get this by cutting the root. And so it stuck in my mind. I remember it right now. And I thought, Major Chester, you're a winner. You really are. So the major's lady and his lovely daughter then were excused, and they got into a vehicle and drove away. And we were left to think, gee, we could eat really well. And we were invited to taste everything that was on the table. This is monkey meat. This is iguana meat. This is snake meat. This is fish. This is root. This is some things. These are berry juices and things like that.
Wow.
Yeah. And then we got to learn how to make our own shelter to sleep in the evening above the ground because of the things that crawl. As I said, they showed us bird-catching spiders, which are about the size of a, let's see, something you would recognize, a small salad plate. And its web was woven across between bushes, and the material was thick enough, the webbing was thick enough, that if a small bird hit it, it got trapped and couldn't fly out, and then the spider would have its meal. Just to see one of those is a real eye-opener. I never did like spiders, but you got to see them.
Yeah, right.
And so we knew all about snakes, and we knew all about the things that crawl. We knew about caiman, which are the alligator or the crocodile of Central America. They're called caiman. And then after we did that, they took us to the Chagres River, and the Chagres River runs into the sea. And at the mouth of the Chagres River, there are sharks, and up in the Chagres River, there are caiman. And so then we were told to take your weapons, and you take your poncho, and you put sprigs of twigs and so forth in your poncho, and then you fold it up and tie it at the top, and voila, it will float. And then you put your rifles and things on top of it, and you strip down, and then you swim across the Chagres River pushing this floating poncho with your weapons. And then we said, didn't you say there were sharks down at the ocean and there were caiman up here? Yes. Don't take a long time when you swim.
Keep moving.
So then we would swim across, and then we would take our weapons and so forth, and then they had these huge trees right on the riverbank with a wire that went back across the Chagres to another huge tree. And then you climbed up the tree, and you put this rope-like thing over the wire, and you put your rifle around your shoulder, and then you hung on for dear life, and you zipped back across the Chagres River, and they would have two guys over there who would catch. They would stop you before you hit the tree.
Before you smacked into the
that
right.
The thing was tied onto. They were successful probably 95% of the time. And that was that. And then we had an escape and evasion course in the jungle. We were given an orange and a canteen of water, and we were put in a prisoner compound, which was surrounded by barbed wire.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were allowed to escape in small groups, and we carried with us a white piece of canvas strip, and you had to have that at the end. And you had to make this point within 24 hours to be successful.
You had to reach a certain place.
We had to reach a certain point. It was so many miles away. And going through the jungle is very slow. Most people don't know that the jungle is all hills, up, down, and all streams and creeks and rivers and up, down, and mud and black palms, snake spiders, and so forth. So you had to make it through. And they would have people from the infantry regiment act as the aggressors, and they would have lines in the jungle where they would be, and they would try and capture us. And if they captured you, they would put a certain mark, an indelible ink mark on your piece of canvas, so that when you got to the end, the umpires would know how many times you had been caught. And if it was too many, why, you didn't pass that course. If you didn't pass that course, you didn't get to be a jungle expert tab wearer and so forth.
Were the ones who were acting as the enemy trying to catch you, were they Americans?
Oh, yeah. They were from the infantry regiment that was stationed there.
Okay.
And they weren't specially trained how to do anything like this. They were assigned it as a task.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, GIs, you will be here and you will be there and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, it's the thickest rainforest in the world. That means it rains a lot. So we had an orange and a canteen, and I had two guys that I thought were very savvy, and I said, okay, we'll be together when we make the break. It's probably better we can take care of each other and be on the lookout and so forth rather than individually, because, boy, if you ever got hurt alone out there, you're in deep trouble. So, okay, we would stick together. So the three of us got out, and we never got caught. We got back with a clean white thing. And we got back that way because we cheated, which we thought was wonderful. We figure they're doing stupid things to us, we'll do stupid things to them.
Okay, like?
Well,
or can you say?
One edge of the track that we had to follow was mangrove swamp that went right to the sea. And you did not want to get in there.
Right.
Mangrove swamp
and
the stuff that's in it, you didn't want to get in there. So that was, I mean, you just knew don't go there. And about a mile and a half in the other direction, there was a road. And they would patrol that road with vehicles. They would drive up and down, making sure you were not allowed to cross the road or go on the road.
Right.
So what we did was very carefully and slowly pick our way along. And at one point, while it was raining so hard, it sounds like a freight train in the jungle when those kinds of torrential rains come. It is deafening. And the three of us passed some infantrymen. We were so close to them, I could have touched their helmets as we went by. But they were all huddled together under their ponchos, staying out of the rain.
Not looking around.
They the hell was looking around.
Right.
They were trying to stay. And we just wanted to get by them. So we got by them and got to the road. And a vehicle came by, and we thought this is probably one of the guards. However, we saw it wasn't one of the guards, so we just waved the vehicle down and said, wouldn't it be great if you helped us snooker those infantry jerks over there, and we'll get in the back of the truck under the tarp, and we will ride. And the guy said, sure, hop in. We hopped in. He drove us down as far as he could. We hopped out, and actually we were now something like 6 or 8 hours ahead of where we'd normally be. So we just holed up for a while, and then when the morning came and you would be expected to appear, we appeared with the clean thing, and everybody was happy. And I thought, this really counts, even though we bent the rules, because if we were really escaping and evading, we would take advantage of everything we possibly could, and there wouldn't be any. So I rationalized my way into thinking it was okay, and voila, it was okay, and that was Jungle Warfare Training Center.
Well, you started off by saying, I mean, that's fascinating. You started off by saying that they that this training center was closed down.
Yes, it was closed down. Then it was opened up again for the Vietnam War.
Okay. Do you know when it had originally developed down there? Was it during World War II or before?
I honestly don't know. It was there when I arrived, and I never questioned how long it had been there.
Yeah.
But it was officially named a fort, and it had permanent barracks and two-story, you know, the typical southern barracks with no glass windows. They just had louvers and screens, and it had a mess building and a headquarters building. So it had obviously been there long before I got there, and I would say it was World War II vintage. Remember, we were going to fight in the jungles going to Japan, so maybe that's what it was. And it was called Fort Sherman, and I guess that was after General Sherman, but I don't know.
The warfare center itself was called Fort
yeah,
Sherman?
Jungle Warfare Training Center at Fort Sherman Canal Zone.
Okay. Let's take a break.
And the
there.
Major was, as I say, Major Chester. Mm-hmm. I don't know his name. He was well thought of. One day when I was driving out of Fort Sherman, I drove behind Major Chester, who had a English car, Austin.
Austin Healey?
No, it wasn't a Healey. No, this had the back seats in it, too.
Okay, then.
It was one of the small, tiny, cheapy English cars, and it had an open top. And he was driving out, and I pulled right in behind him. And just as we drove off Fort Sherman, he jammed on the brakes. I jammed on the brakes. I didn't want to hit him. He looked and jumped out of the car and ran into the edge of the jungle. And I wondered, what's happening? Mm-hmm. He immediately appeared, and he had a boa, a baby boa constrictor, maybe 5-6 feet long, wriggling in his arms. And he threw it into the back seat and threw something on it and turned the car around and drove back into the zoo. He helped populate the zoo.
Yeah, it was adding to the collection.
And I honestly thought you get a little wacko when you live in Panama too long, out in a jungle training center too long. You have your wife dressed up in an evening gown in the jungle.
Yeah.
You jump out and catch boas. So
this guy was theater that he did
he
for
was
you.
Wonderful guy, and they wanted him to be a regular, but they could not get him an infantry regular slot.
Meaning
I'm talking about the general officers who were in the canal zone. But they wanted him to be a regular officer, and lo and behold, somehow or other, magically, there was an opening in the chemical corps, and he got a commission in the chemical corps. How's that?
It's strange.
Not bad.
Yeah.
Not bad.
Yeah. Let's take a break for a minute, Tom.
You bet. Right. Yeah. In 1959, I went through the drill of being the assistant battalion S3, then the battalion S3, and then eventually, just before I left, another major came in, and I went back to being assistant battalion S3, and by then I already had orders to go to the advanced course for artillery officers in Fort Sill again.
Now, was this something that you could have predicted? I mean, that you...
Yes, this was this was a normal, this was the right time, and every regular officer and a lot of the reserve officers were selected to go to the advanced course. That was the next step. And the only leg up I had was the fact that I had spent a year in the Fuel Artillery Surface Missile Battery Officer course, which was a year course in between. And it only lasted, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, and then the Army said, this isn't the best use of our people. We're not really going to have missiles.
Right. That was phased out.
The long, I think the Long John or something.
Yeah.
We're not going to have the rockets and that. So we'll cut that out and save money, and we'll go from the basic course to the advanced course.
So you're one of, you're a graduate of one of maybe five of those surface-to-surface classes?
Yeah, I think there were a total of four.
Four or five.
And I got out of the first one. And two of my classmates in there, I stay in touch with one. As a matter of fact, I was just in touch with him the other day. He made Major General, and the other one made Lieutenant General. He was, his last name was DeLon, so his nickname was Mo, and he was Mo DeLon. And
that's too funny.
the other guy was Niles J. Fulweiler. And Niles was a hell of a good tennis player and a bon vivant and just a great guy to be around. And our gunnery instructor, I'm getting a little ahead, but just quickly, the gunnery instructor that he had when we went back to SIL became very friendly. He became friendly with his wife and family and so on. And they really hit it off and they stayed in touch. And the gunnery instructor went on to be the chief of staff of the United States Army. And
by the name of?
Shy something. I can't remember it. But Niles J. Fulweiler had stayed in touch with him, and they really hit it off, and they kind of stayed together. And
kind of tracking.
Niles made Major General, which was neat. Spent a lot of time in the Pentagon, and then ended up... as the commander of White Sands.
Brilliant.
And he retired, and as I say, he and I stay in touch. And Mo DeLon and I have not stayed in touch. I just remember reading in the Army Times as his career progressed that I think he was lieutenant general. So
interesting
now,
guys.
I am back as the battalion S3, and I get orders for the student officer course, advanced course, and this is... probably July or June 1960, and so I transfer out of the canal zone, and by now I have a six-month-old son. We come up on a troop ship. We stop in Guantanamo Bay for, I think it was 2 days, and I told my wife, I said, boy, I'd love to show you around. Let's see if I can get a vehicle, and so we got off the troop ship, and I called the base headquarters and said, this is Captain Shepard. I would like to have a vehicle so I can drive around. And they said, absolutely, sir. And within the blink of an eye, a vehicle arrived, and the driver jumped out. And as he saluted, he said, you're an Army captain.
That's funny.
And they had visions of some Navy captain.
Oh, sure.
So I had a vehicle, and I drove my wife around, and we looked at stuff. And
can you describe the base as it looked then? This is 1960.
No, I honestly can't.
Don't remember much.
I don't remember a thing about it. There were Marines and there were Navy, and that's all I knew.
Yeah.
And we had to stay. We slept aboard the troop ship, and we were only there for something like 2 nights. And then off we went to the States. And by this time, I had ordered a Triumph TR3 red two-seater convertible, which was delivered to me in Panama from the English factory.
Sweet.
And which, that's what I had. And I realized that with a baby, my wife and I couldn't do that. So when we came back to the States, I bought a new Ford and sold the Triumph TR3 for $1,700.
Ooh.
And if I had kept that thing right now,
yeah.
I can't tell you what it would be worth, but wow.
Darn, I wish you'd had a garage or something. You could have just parked that thing.
I wish I could have just put it up on block, I didn't do that. But I bought a Ford, and we drove. We visited my family, of course,
mm-hmm.
and visited my wife's family. He was an Army colonel who was running the counterintelligence part of the school, the intelligence school. He ran the CI part of it in Fort Hollabird
mm-hmm.
in Dundalk, which is in Maryland. Hollabird, H-O-L-A-B-I-R-D.
Yes, sir.
And that's where the intelligence school was.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in the intelligence.
So he had been moved. Obviously, he had been at Fort Sill earlier.
No, his daughter was.
Oh, his daughter was.
At that time, he was on the Shah of Iran's staff in Iran.
Oh, very interesting.
Mm-hmm. He spoke Farsi.
Mm-hmm.
And was in that kind of a position for a total of about 7 or 8 years. He was a friend of the Shah. And his daughter was going to the University of Oklahoma, and he had been divorced from his then wife and had remarried. And so now he's at Hollabird and
mm-hmm.
CI, which was a great position because
the
reason he was with the Shah was to keep the Russians the hell out of Iran, and so he was doing lots of intelligence and,
mm-hmm.
and counterintelligence stuff and so on. So
what
at
a
this
career.
Point, it was mm-hmm. funny, this was the first time I met him. He had been overseas when we had that sudden marriage.
Right.
And so I queried him. I said, you know, when I was first coming on board in the Army, they wanted me to go to intelligence, and
mm-hmm.
the other guy wanted me to go to thing, and what do you think? And he said, you're a regular officer, and intelligence is still not for regulars. He said, however, in the works, it will be a formal branch, and the minute it is, if you still wanted to do it, that would be the time to make a change. I said, okay, put that in the back of my mind and just keep it there.
Mm-hmm.
So we visited him, and we visited my folks, and then we drove out to Oklahoma, and we started. We were there early. The school didn't start until September, so we had to do what they call snowbirding, and that meant we hung around. And they gave us odd tasks to do. And one task, I had to inspect the WAC barracks for fire hazards and safety, something or other. And so I had the pleasure of doing a formal inspection of the WAC barracks, which was hilarious at that moment.
Was it hilarious to you or just... It would have been to anyone, really.
I think anyone in my position would have found it hilarious. One of the things I found as I walked in, I remember vividly,
mm-hmm.
was a young lady sleeping under her bunk in her underwear.
Mm-hmm.
And the sergeant was nonplussed because she didn't know that she was under the bunk. And I knew because I bent down to look under bunks. And
uh-huh.
there she was. And so she was awakened and... the explanation was something about it was cooler down on the floor or something like that. And so I saw all kinds of things that you don't normally see in an enlisted man's barracks. And,
I'll bet.
I also checked all of the fire extinguishers and looked at the tags to see that they were up to date and met the supply sergeant who had a deeper voice than I did, which... I found disconcerting. And at the end of that inspection, I was very happy to salute and say, well, it looks good to me. I'll send my report in and chogy on out of there.
Were you, I mean, this is something that we talked about before with regard to your posting and observations in Korea. I mean, did it kind of bother you a little that, again, that the Women's Army Corps was there and was on Fort Sill? I mean,
because they were WACs, and WACs had a very specific kind of an assignment.
Uh-huh.
at 18th Airborne Corps, Sally Woy was a WAC. She was a lieutenant, and she was doing administrative stuff.
Yes,
there was never any question that they were going to be in an infantry unit or an artillery unit.
It was a separate corps.
The Women's Army Corps, and they did different things, and they were not in combat, and they generally were not interacting in places where you were isolated. Do you know what I mean? They were generally on a base somewhere, and at the end of the day, it was like any other company. At 5 o'clock, you jumped in your car, and you went downtown and had dinner in a restaurant,
sure,
and went home or something. It wasn't we're all together in these trenches.
Right, and they, as you say, had prescribed duties were...
Right, they were administrative.
Mm-hmm. And assisting in that way the efficient
right.
operations of
they were
the
like
the
waves
military.
In the Navy.
Yeah.
And like the Marines, they called them BAMs,
mm-hmm.
and you were familiar with that,
mm-hmm.
so I don't need to tell you anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But they had their task, and it was separate.
Yeah.
So it was fine.
So that was fine.
It was like, hey, yeah, they're WACs, and we salute, and they salute, and that's it.
Right, okay. What else did you do as a snowbird? Do you remember?
No.
Okay. Moving on.
Actually, I probably spent as much time as I could in the, you know, we had a lovely military library in Snow Hall, and I'm an avid reader, so I probably spent time, we had great military libraries, and I spent time probably looking in things like that, or maybe I was assigned to go down to a gun park and look at something, but generally we were just assigned to things that would keep us busy and keep us out of the way.
Just for interest, Tom, since you in your later iterations, you know, become an academic and have all that, do you remember what your reading interests were during this period?
My reading interests were Catholic in a small C
mm-hmm.
way.
Okay.
I'm omnivorous.
Mm-hmm.
If there's nothing else in the room, I will read the label on the soap dish. I just like to read.
As much fiction as nonfiction?
Much fiction as nonfiction.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Well, and that paid off during what test that?
Yes,
I can't remember
it paid off.
That's right.
It helped out.
That's right.
So I did Snowbird for a month or so, and in the meantime, we were meeting our contemporaries. You know, we were coming in dribs and drabs, and
mm-hmm.
I met a guy who ended up being my neighbor across the street, and he turned out to be a lifelong friend, and he was a regular Army officer and artilleryman, and we just stayed friends forever. He died 2 years ago. So those kinds of, I met Ken Acousti, and we stayed friends forever until he died. So that was a very nice extra. We had time to meet and chat and talk about where were you. I met Tom Young, who had been in Fassenbach, and there was Niles Fulweiler. He had been in Fassenbach, and Niles had spent his time in Washington, and Tom had spent his time in Hawaii and gotten married over there. And so we did all of this kind of cementing relationship.
Mm-hmm. Tom, did you feel in any way at a disadvantage because of Panama being, you know, kind of the backwater that you described it to be? Or did you think you had, you know,
I thought I had made lemonade out of lemons in Panama.
Yeah.
But I did feel a little beneath the pack because I was not a college graduate. I was still 2 years of college, and I had been trying in Panama.
Yeah.
I had great fun telling my students this later. I would tell them, you think it's hard what you're doing? Well, let me tell you, I used to drive from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean and take a one-hour course, and
mm-hmm.
their eyes would bug out, and they would say, he's lying.
Yeah.
And I would say, and then I would drive back from the Atlantic to the Pacific to go to work the next day. And they would, you know, and then I would tell them, hey, I was in Panama, and it was 55 miles each way.
Incredible.
That was true. I would drive, I would finish work, jump in a car. My wife made a sandwich that would be wrapped up.
Mm-hmm.
I would jump in the car with the sandwich and the thermos, I would drive 55 miles to Fort Clayton. I would go into a class being run by Florida State University. I would be there for an hour and 20 minutes, mm-hmm. and then I would drive all the way back again. The classes were set up so that you went two nights a week for an hour and 20 minutes each time, and it was a regular semester, and that's what I did the whole damn time I was in Panama.
Taking history classes?
Or? I was taking history classes.
Uh-huh.
History, history, history.
And your favorite periods to study?
I like everything. Once again, I have Catholic tastes. I can, mm-hmm. I can as easily talk about the Roman Empire as I can about the French Foreign Legion. Mm-hmm. I like everything. So I took whatever history classes were available, early European history, America to 1865.
Mm-hmm.
I took Russian history. If they had a teacher who was willing to come to Panama and teach class, and it was history, and I could get the time off, I would go.
And did you get good instructors? Were they regular FSU?
We had the regular full-time instructors come down. Because for them, it was sort of a kick.
Oh, heck yeah.
You know, particularly during the winter.
Sure.
But they would love coming down there, and
sure.
they had their own quarters provided.
Mm-hmm.
Florida State had a real neat system,
mm-hmm.
And so they were treated well. Their students were avid. I mean, we
oh,
weren't
yeah.
there to fool around.
Yeah.
We wanted to learn.
And you know what a difference that makes in a classroom.
I surely do.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I became very friendly with one instructor that I had a couple of times, and then he stayed on as the administrator in the Panama thing, and he was just a gent. He was so helpful. It was wonderful. So
great.
When I got there, I was still the only guy with 2 years of college, and I didn't have it. And there were, as I said, 189 or 198 of us. We were all regulars,
mm-hmm.
And probably 70% were West Point. So not only didn't I have a college degree, but I wasn't a West Pointer. And my friend Tom was a West Pointer. My mm-hmm. friend Niles wasn't a West Pointer.
Did those guys, did they pick that out in you or find out who? I mean, obviously they would probably already know.
Oh, sure. We all knew where we came from.
Uh-huh.
The first thing is, what's your serial number? What's your date of rank?
Right.
You know, and you
yes.
know you know those things down to the gnat's eyelash.
Yes.
And you know where you come from. And some would condescend, just a few. I could name one or two that I still remember
mm-hmm.
would condescend that, oh, you're from Officer Candidate School, you know, something like that.
Right.
But on the other hand, when I would say, yeah, and I was aide to this one, and I was mm-hmm. administrative assistant to that one, and I was the assistant G3, you were doing what during those times?
Mm-hmm.
And they would have to say, well, I was at the battery firing 105s or something like that. So
right.
it all worked out. And
right.
it's like dogs sniffing one another when you get see them get together. But you meet your friends and
right.
you find good guys and
mm-hmm.
you form friendships. And then the school started. And it was really a marvelous 10 months. We did a lot of good stuff. The classes were the regular artillery kind of a course. I told you we had 500 hours more of gunnery. So I was loaded with gunnery. I had gunnery
oh my
coming
God.
Out my ears. I had it in OCS. I had it in Fassenbach. Here I had it in the advanced course. I had transportation courses where we learned all about vehicles and weights and things,
mm-hmm.
map reading, communications. We learned how to use all of the communication things and so on. And they really kept us going, and they gave us an exam every week. And some of the guys did very well, and some of the other guys just didn't do so very well, but they had all been carefully selected. So I would say even the bottom 20% would have been the middle or the top 10% of a typical grouping of the same rank of officers.
Were there guys who just sort of saw this as kind of layback time and kind of just coasted?
Some coasted, yes.
But
not,
generally.
Not the majority. The,
yeah.
the competitiveness of some of those classes, some of the gunnery classes, we used to say, God, if your pencil rolls off the desk, so-and-so would step on it and break the point, so you'd be behind. And that's where we had the nuclear weapons courses and things like that. And so it was a jam-packed full year in which we made many friends. And while I was there about 3 or 4 months, I got the word passed that I was going to be selected to be an instructor. And I thought, wow, that's neat. I'll buy a house. So I bought a house. And so the year went by, and at the end of the year, we graduated, and lo and behold, I got my orders, and I was an instructor at the artillery school, except the artillery school in Fort Bliss, Texas, which is 660-some miles from Fort Sill.
That's a long commute.
It's a long commute. Yeah. And so I thought, oh, my God, here I've got this house, and guess what? The Army was drawing down yet again, and houses...
Yikes.
You couldn't sell them. And so I ended up in the unenviable position of having a house in one place, and then I couldn't afford to have a house in another place, and I had to sell this house or give it away or something, and I went through all of that trauma, and eventually that worked out, and I ended up as an instructor at the Air Defense School in Fort Bliss, Texas. And I kept muttering, but I'm not Air Defense, I'm an artilleryman. And at this point, the Army changed insignias. All artillerymen wore cross cannon, which is what I wore. But air defense artillerymen suddenly were forced to wear the grasshopper, and that's cross cannons with a missile superimposed straight up in the middle of it. And it looked like a grasshopper with sprayed legs to us mud gunners.
And you,
red legs.
You don't sound too happy about this.
I thought that was terrible. As a matter of fact, I was called in and ordered to put that insignia on because I had been wearing it teaching classes, and this was the Air Defense Center.
Right.
So they
there is that.
Get that on, and so I did. But I got there, and well, lo and behold, one of the dear friend that I had met was also assigned to the Air Defense Center as an instructor. That was Jerry Milam. And he and I sort of became a duo. We really got along. We socialized tremendously after work. Our wives liked one another. And Jerry was an Army brat.
Is this M-I-L-A-M?
M-I-L-A-M. Jerome C. Milam. The middle C stands for Churchill. If you remember, Churchill's mother was Jenny Jerome.
That's right.
So Jerome Churchill Milam.
That was a nice twist.
It was.
Any relation at all?
Did
you know or did you
not
hear?
Not really.
But that's
but
nice,
But it
though.
Was nice.
Mm-hmm.
His dad, now here's an interesting thing. Jerry's father, Jerry's brother was a West Pointer who got killed in Korea. And that's all I know about it. He was an older brother and he was killed in Korea. Jerry did not go to West Point. Jerry went to a civilian college and got an ROTC career after having spent 2 years as an enlisted man. So, Jerry's father had been a trumpeter. Now notice, not a bugler, a trumpeter in a cavalry company that was commanded by a guy who became a general in the Army in the last Indian fights that were going on in the 1880s or 1890s when they were still driving recalcitrants off of this place and on to that place.
Right out here, probably, New Mexico.
Right
or
out in
somewhere.
The New Mexico, Oklahoma, Texas area, right. And Jerry's dad lived to be well into his 90s. And on one occasion, I had the opportunity to visit Colonel Milam, the dad, I liked Jerry so much, and I knew about his father and everything, that Jerry and I decided we would wear our dress blue uniforms. And we had a lovely dinner. And I listened to a guy who had been a trumpeter in the cavalry.
Unbelievable.
I thought, wow, absolutely unbelievable.
Yeah.
So that was very nice. Jerry was an Army brat, and he was my best friend down there, and we ended up both being assigned as instructors in the Air Defense School, and we were going to teach the advanced course, the course I had just graduated from, when they came down. The way the course worked, you were in Fort Sill for 3 months, and then you were transferred to Fort Bliss, for 3 months, and then you were transferred back to Fort Sill for 4 months, and that was the course. So you got artillery for the majority of the time, and you got air defense artillery for a smaller portion of the time.
So your new job was to teach that 3 months?
I was going to teach that three-month thing,
okay.
And I was going to teach tactics, and Jerry was going to also teach tactics, so we got into the same department. And the way it was set up, we worked in an open, we called it the bullpen. It was the school was very new, the buildings were new, and we had a large room in which there were a series of instructors' desks, and we had little partitions, little boards that we wrote things and notes on and so forth, and we had our desk and a couple of chairs. But I could just look up and holler, "Hey, Jerry, did you teach this so-and-so yesterday?" or something like that. Lots of communication, but at the same time, no privacy. There was nothing done that required silence because we were all talking to one another.
Right.
Holyoaks, his father was a lieutenant general. Another guy had Maxwell Taylor's son in his unit and had to give him a bad efficiency report. Jerry was an Army brat. And we, after a while, they sent us to the charm school, which was 2 weeks of learning how to conduct a corps, how to stand at the podium and do a course Army style. And I must tell you, that stood me in such good stead for the rest of my life.
Well, what are the keys there that are that you can remember and that did help you?
Well, first of all, they believed in that you tell them what you're going to tell them, then you tell them, then you tell them what you told them.
Yeah.
They believed in having handouts for everything that obviated the need for precise notes because you were going to give them things. And they could jot down ideas on it, but the gist of it would be there. So instead of writing, they could be looking and listening kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
They believed in that, remember that Chinese thing, what is it, I hear and I forget, I see and I remember, I do and I understand.
Mm-hmm.
So they believed in that. You saw a lot of things and then you had to do it. And that's where the thinking set in. You know, you truly learn by experiencing the results of your own actions. So we tried to give them opportunities to experience things rather than just listen to things.
And not a lot of theory here.
Oh, there was enough theory so that you would understand what a burst locator was and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was visual. You had lots of training aids and so forth.
And were those training aids and so forth already in place, available? And
many of them were in place for the courses that were in place, and we were taught how to use them.
Okay.
And then as we devised courses, I ended up being there almost 4 years, and I ended as a senior instructor. So I devised courses and training aids and things like that.
Okay. So you actually contributed to the development of the curriculum, and not only that,
right,
but also the teaching materials themselves.
Right.
Okay.
And during that, I also did me and another captain did the air defense of Taiwan for the Chinese. And after we did it, the colonel looked it over and put his imprimatur on it. It was sent to the Department of the Army, and we suddenly saw it in one of the Department of the Army newsletters that came out that the Taiwan air defense had been settled and the Taiwanese had accepted it, and Colonel somebody that we never heard of from the Pentagon had done the plan. And I thought, isn't that wonderful? So, captain's rule, that was the way we felt about it. We thought we were really doing a job down there.
Now, how did you come to have that exercise or work in front of you, the issue of Taiwan's air defenses?
By the time I'd been there 3 years,
you were
I was Mr. Air Defense. I taught so many classes. When I was a college professor, if I spent 3 hours a day in a classroom, that was the heavy day.
Yes, right.
That was the real heavy day.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, it was 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
When the drawdown came for Vietnam, starting in about 1962, my section that I was in charge of had 7 instructors and me, and shortly thereafter it had me and one other guy, and I was on the platform 40 hours a week, 8 to 5. I was lecturing.
I mean, anybody who's taught, that's just back. I mean, I can't even imagine.
It's killing.
Yeah.
But I went in to complain to the colonel, whom we called the low-order burst. As you know, a nuclear weapon that falls from a plane and is not set to explode, if it hits the ground, the worst that can happen is the detonators on it go off, and it makes a low-order burst.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was the colonel. When he got really excited, had a vein that came up on his forehead that literally moved a half inch in each direction as he hollered. So that was the low-order burst.
Mm-hmm.
And I went in and told him, Colonel, you know, we can't do this. I once had 7, now and he told me, when you show me a body on the floor of the classroom, I'll get busy. How's that?
Well, that's clear.
That's clear.
Mm-hmm.
The drawdown was very, very heavy indeed when it happened. But the first couple of years, it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first couple of years were great, wonderful, some of the happiest times I've had in the Army then. We had this tremendous camaraderie amongst the instructors when we would be in the bullpen. And the students provide a continual series of hilarious events and so forth. I was once assigned to teach a class that had something like 12 different nationalities in it. And we had to keep the Israelis in the front, and we had to keep the Arabs in the back so they wouldn't be too close to each other. We had the Greeks over here, and we had the Turks over there. And I must tell you, I am a stickler for honesty in a classroom situation.
Mm-hmm.
And when I would hear, as I was writing a question on the board and they were taking a quiz, I would hear, lava, hey, whatava. It was one of the Greeks hollering to another Greek all the way across the room in Greek, something about what's the answer.
Exactly.
And then I would turn around and fiercely look at them, and later I got the word, cool it. And I was all upset. I was irate. I said, but these are exams. They're cheating on it. And they said, listen, someday you'll understand. This is a political thing, and it's best if you just don't ever see anyone cheating. Do you understand me? Yes, sir. And that was that. So, but for American officers, that was not that. They didn't get that political understanding. They didn't. And on one occasion, I read a piece that they had to turn in essays on various topics.
Sure.
And I was reading a piece, and I said, I know the next sentence that's coming. And the next sentence, I know it. And I said, aha.
Mm.
And I went down to the library, and I looked and looked, and I come back with the complete book that had been plagiarized from.
Mm-hmm.
Word for word.
About how much?
Couple of paragraphs,
mm-hmm.
just word for word.
Yep.
And so I turned that in, and the young officer was removed from the course. I don't know how they adjudicated that on his record or what. I don't know. But I could not sit still for plagiarism or cheating if I could help it. Sometimes you can't help it, but if I could help it, I didn't go for that. So that was when I was beginning to learn about politics.
Mm.
It was okay for the Greeks, it was okay for anyone else, but not for Americans. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I did for 3.5 years, I guess, was teach a variety of courses. And after the second year, I think, I was selected to teach the modern warfare course, which was a very highly thought of course that was taught over in the nuclear weapons section, and you had to be a major or above to be selected for it, and they came from all over the Army for this one-week course where we talked about the weapons that we expected to have on the battlefield and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the classes I taught was the Mauler, This was going to be a tracked vehicle that on the top had a pod of something like 9 anti-aircraft rockets, and it would be radar guided and so forth, and there would be 5 or 6 of them in a platoon, and they would be connected by communications so that one more could pick up an incoming plane at a certain altitude and pass the information to another Mauler, and it could fire a weapon. It could fire and lock on a new target in 3.5 seconds.
Wow.
And it was going to be able to swim across rivers. And, boy, I taught this as if it were right there in the back of the shed and I could take you out and show it to you. But, of course, it was just on the drawing board. And one of the things that I cooked up to make it vivid, I had a wonderful sergeant who was my assistant instructor, AI.
Mm-hmm.
And for the Mauler presentation, when I was telling him how fast it could acquire and fire, he was in the back of this darkened small theater classroom, and he had a little model plane that was on a piece of piano wire that ran from him all the way down over my head. And in the darkness of the theater, you couldn't see it. And it had a sparklet bulb in the rear of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And as I would give the cue, he would he'd pop the sparklet bulb, and this thing would come zipping down. And I had a capped pistol under the podium. And as it, in the back of the room, you would just suddenly hear, as it started, and as people turned, I whipped out the blank firing gun, and I would go, bang, bang! And the front 2 or 3 rows would leave their seats about 6 inches and come flopping back down as this thing went over my head. And then I would put the gun back down, and I would say, well, probably that fast anyhow. And then, of course, they would all laugh, and everybody would be wide awake for a long time.
Yeah, there's something to be said for visuals. I mean,
yes.
You know, and audience
that,
participation.
That course was rehearsed, Laura, to the point when I wanted slides changed or
mm-hmm.
anything, I didn't have to walk over and push a button.
Mm-hmm.
I had a body language thing that my AI would watch me,
mm-hmm.
and when I made a certain move or touched a certain part of the podium, he would change the slide. So I would not even interrupt the flow of talk. I would be able to say something like, it will acquire in so many seconds, and I would make that physical movement, and boom, this thing would light up behind me. We had one of those ground glass screens that with the rear projection thing.
Sure, yep.
And it would pop up, and I could make it change, and it was so smooth and effortless.
Seamless, yeah.
It was really neat.
Cool.
But boy, the rehearsal that went into that was incredible. And we taught lots of, I taught the chief staff of the Mexican Army, and we just had a constant parade of VIPs coming through, and this was the showpiece for them.
Would you have anybody, for example, from the State Department, senior personnel coming into a course like this?
I did not, but I had French, I had some officers who had served in the French Foreign Legion,
uh-huh.
and I remember
wow.
coming out to talk to them
mm-hmm.
and looking down and seeing a guy with only one arm and medals that covered his whole chest, and I knew he had been in the Legion, and mm-hmm. I'm thinking, and here I am up here instructing, and it made me really feel kind of weird,
yeah.
but...
Yeah,
you go through it.
Mm-hmm.
I was also assigned on many occasions to teach the Luftwaffe. Their air defense is part of the Luftwaffe, and they had an air defense school right at Fort Bliss, and they would send whole contingents of officers, and they would stay over there for a long time because they could also fire the missiles over there, and they couldn't fire them in Germany. And so I've taught classrooms full of Germans with a brigadier general, German brigadier general, as the class leader, and I was a captain, and I can remember standing outside the classroom and hyperventilating to
mm-hmm.
get oxygen, because when I walked in, the body odor would make my eyes almost tear. And as I walked in, holding my breath so that I didn't gag, the brigadier general would leap to his feet, holler, "Achtung," they would all leap to their feet. He would salute and report to me. And at the first break, I asked him, "Please, General, I'm a captain, you're a general, you don't report to me." And he told me, "Oh, no, you are the teacher or the professor," mm-hmm. "or whatever, and mm-hmm. I report to you." So they insisted on having an interpreter, even though everybody in the class
yeah.
spoke English.
Sure, sure.
But by having an interpreter, the classes were twice as long, which meant they had time to ask 100% more questions than they normally would.
And did they?
And did they, indeed.
Mm-hmm.
They were minutia-oriented.
Yeah.
They were minutia-oriented.
Yeah.
And it was very interesting. They were just a different culture. And if they had only used underarm deodorant or bathed more often, the whole class would have been a pleasure. But they didn't. It wasn't. But nonetheless, we taught scads of German anti-aircraft.
I mean, was that at all kind of creepy to have, you know, German officers?
No, we had already been indoctrinated with the Germans are our friends, the Russians are our enemies. That was pretty clear by then.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, this was 1961, 62,
sure.
63. I also taught battalions of Chinese, Taiwanese
mm-hmm.
Chinese,
mm-hmm.
And they had an interesting arrangement. Their low-ranking enlisted men, their technicians and so on, would come over for, they would stay for almost 36 months learning the ins and outs of all of the technical aspects of the Nike Hercules and how to fix it and everything like that. Their higher-ranking people would come in, like the warrant officers and so on. They would come in for 12 or 16 months, and then the officers of the battalion, they would come in for 6 or 8 months. And then the graduation would take place, and then the whole unit would go back to Taiwan. And we taught them the Hawk, and we taught them the Nike Hercules. And it was fun.
Do you have any sense of how many, for example, Nike installations there would have been in Taiwan during this time?
No. I did the Hawk defense, and
mm-hmm.
I did that in 1963.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea. We situated the Hawk based on where the Hercs were,
mm-hmm.
and we did all of the burst locator stuff to find out what the low altitude approaches would be and how to best cover them. But 63 to 2006, I really
yeah.
don't remember the details
yeah.
of it.
But still extremely interesting and tells a lot about
yeah.
what you know what.
They were buying. They were buying this stuff,
yeah.
and
mm-hmm.
we were teaching them how to use it,
mm-hmm.
and it was in our benefit in both instances. They kept the communist Chinese out of Taiwan, and it kept us our defense industry selling stuff. So you know that was a winner on all sides.
Did the Taiwanese impress you as particularly?
I found them to be very meticulous.
Mm-hmm.
And also a little bit stubborn, and they were not at all like the Japanese, I mean like the German meticulousness. It was, the culture was so entirely different, and their faces were so unreadable to me at that time. You know how they say they all look alike?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they don't all look alike, but their expressions are not readable until you've been among them for a long time. And so they were sort of blanks. I didn't know how to explain it better than that, but you didn't get the same kind of feeling.
And you couldn't really tell? I mean, is it accurate to say you couldn't really tell whether you were getting across?
Oh, I knew that the material was getting across.
Right, but
they had to take exams,
sure.
and I could look at them.
Sure.
They were getting the stuff.
Right. But how they were, like, reacting off you, you know?
But
how
I don't know how they were reacting
uh-huh.
off of us, and like they gave a hell of a party at the end. They threw a party where I learned the Chinese words gambei, which you may know as bottoms up. And those buggers would come up to each of us each officer in the battalion would come up and want to have the toast, and he would make a little toast and then say gambe, and I would drink the toast with him.
Mm-hmm.
But then the next officer came up to drink the toast, and then the next officer came up to drink the toast, and then the next officer, and there were 12 to 14 or 15 officers, which is 15 shots, which is
Yikes.
Most of a bottle.
Yep, you could die.
Me walking, falling down, drunk at the end, sick, but protocol demanded that we do all these kinds
right.
of things.
Right.
Happily, they only graduate once, and then they were gone.
Well, during this time, and before you left for your next assignment,
yeah.
The president was shot and killed.
Yes, he
and
was.
I wonder, just as a timeline question, can you tell me what you remember about
that? I can tell
that?
You exactly what I was doing
sure.
when he was killed.
Uh-huh.
I was sitting at my desk in the bullpen. It was like 11:30 in the morning where I was.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, I'm in Fort Bliss, which is an hour different from Dallas. The phone, the room is empty because it's lunchtime, and I'm having a sandwich at my desk because I have a 1 o'clock class to teach. The phone rings, I pick it up, it's my then-wife calling,
mm-hmm.
and she says, the president has been shot, and they think he may be dead. I was stunned. I didn't say, are you kidding, or something like that, but I was stunned. And she kept saying, he's been shot, he was in Dallas, he was shot, and so forth. I said, okay, you know, thanks, hon. And I hung up, and I went immediately to the colonel's office. And I said, Colonel, did you hear that the president's been shot? No, I didn't. Oh, then they started trying to turn on radios, get to a television, what's going on. And I was so affected by that. When the class met at, I guess, 1 o'clock, and I walked up, I was too choked up to do anything. And I told them, gentlemen, the president's been shot, and I can't teach this class. So you're dismissed, and I walked off. And I remember that vividly. And I also remember that about 2 or 3 days later, the exec of the department called me in and chewed my ass out,
mm-hmm.
wanting to know who I was to dismiss a class. And I wondered, who are you? What are you made out of? I mean,
what's wrong with you?
Feel, you idiot.
Yeah.
Well, he was one of those numbnuts majors that float around occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
And but that passed right over. Nobody was going to take him up on that kind of a thing. And so, yeah, that's where I was. I was in the office. My wife called, and I had a class to teach, and I couldn't teach it.
Had you been watching the president's progress, not through Texas, but I mean as a politician and as a statesman?
Oh, certainly. I was aware of, you know, Camelot. I mean, you couldn't escape
mm-hmm.
that stuff. And I didn't agree with his politics, and I thought his brother was the most dangerous man in America.
Really?
Not Teddy.
Mm-hmm. No, not the brainy
Teddy.
One.
He was the brainless man in America.
Right.
His brother was the most dangerous yeah. man in America.
Uh-huh.
And so, sure, I
now,
following John F. Kennedy.
I mean, I haven't asked you about the Cuban Missile Crisis, and maybe I ought to. Just if you quickly remember that period and
sure,
what impact it had.
It was very special because I remember I told you I had been assigned to this modern warfare course
sure.
and it was so carefully controlled and so forth and so on.
Right.
And the guy sitting our desks there, we were not in bullpens. We had offices with two officers, and our desks were pushed face-to-face, so we faced one another. And
mm-hmm.
I was in the office with William B. Burdishaw, who became a brigadier general and now runs Burdishaw Associates, which is sometimes called Rent-A-General
mm-hmm.
organization.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill and I were office mates and so on. He was a West Pointer, and we were talking one day, and I don't know how the subject came up, but I told him I had been applying for the 6-month bootstrap course because I had enough credits. I had something like 140 credits, and you needed 124 to graduate, but you had to do 6 months at Florida State. And I told him I had been trying to get that, and every time they say, well, you've just been assigned as the senior instructor, oh, you've just been assigned to the advanced course, oh, you've... And I said, I don't know if I'm ever going to get it finished. And he said, well, have you called your detailer? Have you called so-and-so in the artillery branch? And, you know, I'm agape. No. Well, it seems West Pointers know better than non-West Pointers, and he said, well, that's Major Blotz up there. He's here, let me help you. He picked up the phone, and he called the Pentagon, and he got Major Blotz. And apparently he knew him and said, hi, blah, 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 blah. Here, Tom, and he handed me the phone. Mm-hmm. And the guy on the other end said, Bertishaw tells me that you need 6 months and so forth. Hold on, let me look at your records. And then he went off the phone, and he came back, and he said, okay, I'll send you a set of records. Now, are you sure you can do it in 6 months? Yes, sir. Okay, I'll cut the records and send them. I'll cut them down. Your orders will be there. And that was that.
Just
the
like
orders
that.
Came down. And I was stunned. I had tried for so long and so hard, I figured it'll never happen. A set of orders came, and off I went for 6 months. And while I was there, the Cuban Missile Crisis happened. Mm-hmm. I was a captain on active duty. I was getting my undergraduate degree in history.
Mm-hmm.
I was at Florida State, which is in Tallahassee, and the Cuban Missile Crisis came, and people knew I was an Army officer, and they would come to me and say, do you think this means war? And I would say, no. I learned long ago that you should always be calm and make people feel more comfortable.
Right.
So I would say no.
The correct answer.
I didn't know what the hell else to say.
Right.
In the meantime, back at the Army units, they were gearing up and sending people down, and all kinds of gyrations were going on. But I was going to class every day and telling people, don't worry. And at the end of 6 months, voila, I had graduated. I had a nice grade point average, and I came back.
And what year then was the degree awarded, just for the record?
Well, just for the record, I'm looking at it right now.
Uh-huh.
And it was awarded in, hold on, 1962. The year of our Lord, 1962.
Mm-hmm.
22nd day of December.
Well, so I mean, that was a huge...
That was such a relief,
yeah.
I couldn't tell you.
Huge monkey off your back, I mean, in
exactly.
some ways.
But
yeah.
It had really given me a taste for academe. I find that I liked learning. I really was thrilled with learning. So that kind of lit the fire.
Well,
so I came back,
uh-huh.
and I found that the major who was in charge of our department, Bill Bertishaw was a captain, I was a captain, so on, the major took great umbrage that I had left to go to finish bootstrap to get my degree. He thought that was not being a team player. I was devastated. Why would you think that? But that's what he thought. He was the son. Well, and you don't want to go in there.
Well, did that have consequences for you?
Yes, it did. He thought that I wasn't as loyal to the group as I should have been.
To the faculty of instructors there? Is that
yeah,
what you meant?
Yeah, right. He thought that I was a key player in this and
uh-huh.
that I should have foregone that degree, that 6 months. I could always get that another time. And I mm-hmm. explained to him, it was 14 years since the day I started college until I graduated. 14 years. Surely you could let me have the 6 months that it took. But anyhow.
He wasn't going to be persuaded necessarily.
He was not persuaded. He just thought that. His wife was the daughter of a lieutenant general. He had been selected to go to the French École Militaire, which was a real plum.
Oh, yeah.
You know, to be the foreign officer sent over so that he could hobnob with the French. He spoke French. His wife spoke French and so forth. And
mm-hmm.
the end of the story is he went to Vietnam. One day he was invited to go up on an aerial reconnaissance to look at a battle that was going on. He was in L-19 back seat. He went up, and a round came through the back of the plane, right through his back, out his chest, and he was dead.
Mm.
End of that story. So,
well, we've just got a couple of minutes. I know that you're needing to leave.
I'm watching the clock.
We've
got 5 minutes.
In 5 minutes, can you tell me why you thought in 1962-3 that Robert Kennedy was the most dangerous man in America? I mean, if you don't want to say it, it's fine.
But it's
interesting comment.
Okay, well, I'll be able to tell you more.
Okay.
When I tell you about seeing him personally in action,
mm-hmm.
which cemented my view.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that comes next after this assignment.
Okay.
But before that, just from my reading, I was appalled that the president appointed his brother as the attorney general. I had read extensively on the antipathy that took place between Lyndon Johnson and Bobby. So I was aware of the politics, and
mm-hmm.
I was staunchly against his side of the fence. I didn't think they were doing the right things. I thought they were weakening us. Remember, the army had been drawn down and so forth
yes.
and so on.
Uh-huh.
So more later on.
Okay,
that.
All right.
Okay.
Well, let's take a break there then.
And I get a call from my father-in-law who says the intelligence branch has just become a recognized branch. And if you are still interested in intelligence, let me know and send me a letter. I let him know right then, sent him a letter right then,
mm-hmm.
and the machinery was put in place, and I switched branches probably a month later from artillery to military intelligence. And at that note, I then couldn't wear the grasshopper. I wore the new branch insignia, which, as you know, is the blue rose, you know, sub rosa, secret,
mm-hmm.
and the dagger, and so on. And I had that on, and that caused many questions with the students. What's that? Because they had
never seen
anything like that before.
Yeah.
And so I was now out of the artillery, and I was still the instructor there, but my orders were on the way down because, you know, the Vietnam thing had picked up. My friend Max Taylor, I should say Max Thurman, was pulled out in 62. A couple of other guys I knew were pulled out in 63. The drawdown came. I was losing my instructors, and all of this was fomenting, and then I got orders to the Defense Intelligence College in Washington.
And the switch was very rapid for you.
Oh, yeah.
My
father-in-law was in a position, since this was a brand new branch,
uh-huh.
he had been in intelligence most of his entire career, and at that moment had been running the part of the intelligence school at Holabird.
Right.
He was in a perfect position to make sure my paperwork didn't get stuck in an outbox somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And they were looking for regular officers who would make the change. There was still, you know, a lot of caution about, well, is this going to be real and so on. And I threw caution to the winds and said, let's do it. So,
yeah, I would imagine there were a lot of regular Army personnel at your rank who were like, no way.
Oh, yeah.
No
That's
way
right.
would I change out of...
Exactly. Yeah. They said, hey, West Point didn't teach me about MI.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so no way am I going to do that. And I, on the other hand, said, well, I'm from OCS, and I just finished my degree after 14 years. And I liked what I was... Every intelligence assignment I had worked out wonderfully, and I thought, well, I like it. So I made the change, and my orders came down and said, report to Washington. It was then the Defense Intelligence School. It became the Defense Intelligence College. And my contemporaries were now looking forward to going to Command and General Staff
mm-hmm.
in Leavenworth,
mm-hmm.
and I was looking forward to a year in this school in Washington.